going to call this meeting of the TRPA Governing Board to order. The date is Wednesday, June 23, 2021. It's 10:45 a.m. and we are having a virtual meeting today. The first item on the agenda is roll call to determine a quorum. Maria?
Ms. Alding?
Here.
Mr. Beyer?
Here.
Mr. Bruce?
Here.
Mrs. Sagaski?
I'm here.
Ms. Faustinos? Mr. Friedrich?
Here.
Ms. Gustafson?
Here.
Mr. Hicks?
Here.
Ms. Hill?
Here.
Mr. Lawrence?
Here.
Ms. Novacell?
Here.
Mr. Rice? Mr. Rice? Ms. Williamson?
Here.
Mr. Yates?
Here.
Mr. Chair, we have a quorum.
Great, thank you. And before I get into the rules for the day, we do have some exciting news that I'm hoping it's okay that I share. On June 15th, Haley Williamson, our fantastic new member of the board, had a baby girl. And I understand that she's healthy and happy, and we're really happy for you, Haley. And we're welcoming that our newest TRPA family member to the quorum. So
thank you. Thank you so much. That's so kind. Thank you. We're doing great.
Absolutely.
Congratulations, okay. Haley. My daughter was born 15 years ago on June 17th. So
nice. Summer I'm babies.
Sure. Oh, somebody unmuted me. Thank you. I'm here.
Excellent. Welcome, Wes. Okay. So now we'll go over the rules of the day. To observe and participate in the meeting, go to www.trpa.gov, select June 23, 2021, Governing Board Meeting on the calendar, and follow the link to the webinar. Members of the public can find all meeting materials there as well. To participate in the Governing Board Meeting with your comments, please utilize the hand-raising function in the GoToWebinar platform at the appropriate agenda item. If you wish to make a comment about something not in the agenda, we will hear your comments during the general public comment period at the end of the meeting, agenda item 13. With your hand raised, you will be unmuted by TRPA staff and have 3 minutes to address the governing board. If you have contacted the TRPA for reasonable accommodation and received a unique PIN for dial-in, please make sure you enter that PIN so that you will be identified and unmuted by TRPA staff. If you're using GoToWebinar's Instant Join web app, please make sure it is opened in the Google Chrome browser and that you allow access to your microphone in order to be unmuted. If you're joining via the call-in number posted on our website, please note this is listen-only option. If you wish to address the governing board, you will need to log in via GoToWebinar on your computer, tablet or smartphone, or dial your unique PIN number. To governing board members, if you wish to speak, please alert me by the chat function if you're online, or speak up if you're calling in. And if you can't get to the chat function quickly enough, just jump in and you'll have the floor. Please set your chat box now to message panelists and organizers to ensure that I see your message. Board members may only use the chat function to indicate desire to speak. This function must not be used to have a sidebar conversation. And finally, everyone remember to mute your mic unless speaking to cut down on the background noise. I would also like to have all members turn on their cameras as we now have sufficient capacity on our platform to accommodate all members on the video to the extent that you can. Okay, we are moving to agenda item number 2. And a slight deviation from past practice, I would like to ask Catherine if she would please lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Excellent. Thank you so much. We really appreciate that, Catherine. You did a fantastic job. I think you're hired. It's just, it's easier if we do it that way than if everybody tries to jump in and we can't hear anybody. So thank you, Catherine. I appreciate it. Okay, moving on to agenda item number three, approval of the agenda. Let's see, Joanne, is there any changes to the agenda?
There are no changes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We'll deem the agenda approved as posted. Agenda item number four, approval of minutes. We have a set of minutes from the May 26, 2021 Governing Board meeting. Are there any questions, comments, or changes?
I'm sure you were expecting this, Mr. Chairman. I had some minor clerical corrections that I shared with Maria. So I'm prepared to make a motion to approve the minutes from the May 26, 2021 Governing Board meeting, subject to those corrections.
Excellent. We have a motion. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes. Okay, we're moving to item number five, agenda item five. This is the TRPA consent calendar. There are five items on the consent. Three items were reviewed by Operations and Governments Committee. One was reviewed by the ARPIC committee, and one was not reviewed by any committee. As a reminder to the public, after board discussion on this item, you may raise your hand in the GoToWebinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff to share your comments. Okay, I'd like to jump to Shelley. And Shelley, if you could please give us a report from Operations and Governance with respect to the consent items, that would be great.
Certainly. As noted, the Operations and Governance Committee reviewed items 1, 2, and 3. When we discussed the May financials, Chris noted, which is good news for the agency, that we have a substantial ending fund balance for the month for the this particular financial report. The fiscal year 2021-2022 annual budget. Some of the highlights that I think are significant is that California did not implement its previously proposed $250,000 funding cut, and the $500,000 for building improvements associated with last year's fiscal year bond refinancing is being spent in this upcoming fiscal year, hence the $500,000, and I'm using air quotes here, budget deficit. Chris is on the line. If anyone wants to pull either one of those items for a more detailed summary. And then we also reviewed item number 3. In each instance, the committee recommended approval unanimously of each item.
Great. Thank you very much, Shelley, for that report. Before I ask if anybody has any questions on that, I would like to just note for anybody who jumped on a little bit late, maybe, or after I made the announcement, because I made the announcement a couple minutes before we had the meeting. If you're on the board and you have the ability to be on the video, please share your video, because that is a new process and a new format that we are using now that we have the technology to do so. Okay, so now we're moving on to, discussion regarding Shelley's report back from operations. Anybody? I do not see any questions or comments regarding that, and I'd like to move to Bill. Can you give us a report for the Regional Plan Implementation Committee meeting earlier this morning?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Regional Plan Implementation Committee reviewed the revision necessary from our former air quality mitigation fee to the new mobility mitigation fee, which we approved, back in April, or maybe it's June, no, April. Now it's June. Anyway, it was during the VMT discussion. And really this, they just simply had to convert the air quality mitigation fee was based on trips. And obviously the mobility mitigation fee is now based on vehicle miles traveled. So they made a conversion from trips to vehicle miles traveled. And that was presented to the committee. The committee unanimously recommended approval of this minor change. And there was discussion of in the future, we will be talking about doing other things consistent with what we approved regarding the vehicle miles reduction program overall and our threshold.
Great. Thank you, Bill, for the report. Does anybody have any questions or comments on that? I don't see anything in the chat box. Seeing none, we'll move to the consent calendar item number 4, which is the APC membership reappointment for Douglas County, lay member Garth Ayling. The staff report for this item can be found on page 97 of your packets. Is there any discussion or questions or comments on this item? And again, I'm looking at the chat. I don't see anything on the chat. No one's jumping in. So at this point in time, I would like to go to public comment for consent. If any member of the public wishes to address the governing board on this item, please raise your hand now and go to webinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff. And now I'd like to turn it over to Catherine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are no hands raised to make a comment on this item.
Okay, so I will close public comment and I will ask for a motion on the consent calendar.
Mr. Chair, I'll move approval of the consent calendar.
Okay, I have a motion. And Maria, will you please take roll?
Ms. Alding?
Yes.
Mr. Beyer?
Yes.
Mrs. Sagaski?
Yes.
Ms. Faustinos? Ms. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Friedrich?
Yes.
Mr. Lawrence?
Yes.
Ms. Gustafson?
Yes.
Mr. Rice?
Yes.
Ms. Novosel?
Yes.
Ms. Williamson?
Yes.
Mr. Yates?
Yes.
Mr. Bruce?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, that motion passes.
Excellent. Thank you so much. We will move to agenda item number 6. And there are subsections here, so let's start with 6A. This is the briefing on the Resort Triangle Transportation Plan. Information on this item can be found on page 99 of your packet. As a reminder to the public, after staff presentation and board discussion on this item, you may raise your hand in the GoToWebinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff to share your comments. At this point in time, I'd like to pass it over to Michelle Quickert, and she will introduce Stephanie Holloway to present.
Good morning. Thank you.
Hi, Michelle.
Hello, and members of the board. Can you hear me? Okay.
Yes, yeah? I can.
Fantastic. Good morning, everyone. Michelle Glickert, Transportation Planning Program Manager. Today, I'm going to be providing a little background and then turn it over, as Mark said. Corridor planning is the bridge between the regional transportation plan's goals and policies, the implementation and long-term operation of multi-benefit projects. It's also the region's approach to comprehensively addressing its largest challenges. The corridor planning framework was developed to increase collaboration and accelerate transportation improvements that often cross jurisdictional boundaries. The Tahoe region is divided into 6 corridors based on the unique transportation, recreation, and quality of life needs of each. Today, Stephanie Holloway, Senior Civil Engineer of Placer County Public Works, is going to provide a briefing on the recently adopted Resort Triangle Transportation Plan. That's the corridor plan for the 2889 area on the north and west shore of Tahoe. It also includes our Truckee partners. That's the tip of the triangle. Worth noting is Truckee is our Amtrak connection and served by TART Transit, which is also in Placer County Public Works. Corridor planning allows TRPA to leverage its transportation and land use policies to create synergies and maximize the cost efficiencies and benefits of projects. The approach to each corridor is adaptive to recognize and respond to localized needs, but planning always includes active transportation, sustainable recreation, some even have housing considerations, as well as development within and near town and regional centers. Staff participated from the onset on several committees and technical working groups to ensure consistency with our regional transportation plan. The RTP includes a project spotlight within the planning context chapter. It also highlights the Resort Triangle Transportation Plan. This plan should look familiar as it incorporates RTP strategies you recently approved. Placer County is leading the charge, applying these strategies to their area. It is really the action plan that implements the RTP. And with that, I will turn it over to Stephanie for an overview of the plan, and I'll also be available after her presentation for any questions that you might have.
Great, thanks, Michelle. Can everybody hear me okay?
Thumbs up. My apologies. Next slide. I was not paying attention there. There's the corridor plan on the left showing those six corridor areas. Thank you.
Great, thanks, Michelle. Good morning, Chairman, members of the TRPA Governing Board. Again, my name is Stephanie Holloway. I'm a senior engineer at Placer County, and I am really pleased to be here and excited to talk to you this morning about our final Resort Triangle Transportation Plan. So the Placer County Board of Supervisors considered and approved this plan for Eastern Placer back in October of last year. Just to touch briefly on the geography here, Michelle mentioned the corridor planning effort in the basin. The Resort Triangle Plan was really developed to extend that transportation focus, and the plan encompasses the entire area of Eastern Placer County in and outside of the Tahoe Basin. We have commonly call this the Resort Triangle area here in Placer, and more specifically, it's the area between the North Lake Tahoe area and the I-80 corridor and Truckee. So just to give you a little bit of background on the need for the plan, so this effort really emerged out of the adoption of our transit, our TART systems plan back in 2016, as well as the Placer County Tahoe Basin Area Plan, which you all were involved in 2017. And it's really, as Michelle mentioned, intended to provide us a refined focus on the transportation initiatives that were seeded with TRPA's Regional Transportation Plan. Two efforts that I'll also highlight that preceded this Resort Triangle Plan was the board's adoption of the North Lake Tahoe Transportation Demand Management Strategy. So you'll hear me talk about that term later on in the presentation. That came in the wake of our area plan adoption. And then the state's requirements for vehicle miles traveled as our California Environmental Quality Act metric under Senate Bill 743 in July of last year. So a lot of transportation initiatives over the last 5 years. We're really excited to bring what we think is the start of an implementation for that. I do want to mention that the plan itself was made possible through a Caltrans Sustainable Planning Grant. And I'll ask you to move to the next slide. So the main objectives here, you know, the programs in the plan really strive to lessen our travel via the personal vehicle. We talk a lot about that. We want to improve the transportation experience for our residences and visitors, all the while really minimizing our environmental effects. Next slide. So I do want to take a stop here and just briefly mention, as Michelle highlighted, this plan was developed in concert with your regional transportation plan, and it really is aligned with the goals that are in that plan, which are highlighted here. It's really intended to bring a little bit more detail and moving those high level program ideas and initiatives into implementation. It also, the resort plan also bridges a divide in Placer County between two planning, regional planning agencies, one in the basin with your jurisdiction, TRPA, And then also outside of the basin, the SACOG, or the Sacramento Area Council of Governments, is our MPO and our regional planning agency for the portions that are immediately outside of the basin. So really desiring to bring continuity and connectivity in Eastern Placer between those two areas. Next slide. So I'll jump into the four focus areas here that are in the plan. First, highlighting adaptive corridor management. So these strategies are really intended for our long distance trips and the entry points into the Placer portion of the Tahoe Basin. These are predominantly on our state highways in the resort triangle. Again, the key emphasis of adaptive corridor management is promotion of transit usage. Talk a little bit about parking management. Provides us really with a better system in which to manage the attractiveness of vehicle usage. Transportation demand management strategies, or TDM, as I'll use later in the presentation, focuses on our travel choices and alternatives, specifically transit shuttles, and then also a focus on just reducing the overall vehicle trips that we make. And then lastly, again, I wanted to just mention the efforts in the plan and their relation with our goals on vehicle miles traveled reduction. VMT is really a focus of our region, and we believe that the programs in the Resort Triangle Transportation Plan implement those needed steps for VMT reduction. Next slide. So highlighting our outreach effort here during the resort plan development, we organized two separate stakeholder groups. One focused on our technical nature, and Michelle mentioned TRPA was a stakeholder in that group, looking at technical recommendations. The other was really a community outreach and a community-focused stakeholder group, really helping us to kind of inform the plan and seed the plan in the community. Those two groups helped us immensely in developing the final strategies. Our outreach also, you know, included a broader conversation and a virtual community outreach workshop that we held actually online during the pandemic, reaching out to hundreds of community members and stakeholders and receiving virtual comments that again inform the plan. And I'll go over some of that feedback that we got as part of both the stakeholder groups as well as the virtual community workshop that we held. Next slide. So jumping into the details here, I'm going to start with adaptive corridor management. So this term was initially introduced to me from my partners and colleagues at TRPA during conversations and adoption of the Tahoe Basin Area Plan. So in short, the question really boiled down to, you know, how do we better manage and utilize our current infrastructure during peak periods of travel demand? So there were four alternatives that we considered in the plan, including bus on shoulder initiatives, which I know has been a focus of discussion with the bi-state group. So different options, as I mentioned, were studied and vetted. And ultimately, the answer that rose to the top for us and for the stakeholders during community meetings really was this reversible bus-only center running lane on Highway 89 and 267. And I'll have you jump to the next slide, show you a concept plan of that. But I do think it's important to note and recognize that development of this strategy, this bus-only reversible lane, was developed in close conversation and consultation with both Caltrans and CHP. They really had a lot of operational and safety concerns that we heard, and we hope that this solution addresses that. On the right on this slide, you'll see an example of implementation of this. This is actually in Sacramento off the Highway 50 corridor, one of the overpasses here. And they do run this as an adaptive lane, a directional lane, in the center of the roadway. I believe this is on Mott Avenue. So next slide. So the vision for our bus only lane is really broken down into near term and long term parts. So I'll talk a little bit about our initial implementation, our phase one, really looking to upgrade our signals along these two corridors with transit signal priorities. So some signal equipment upgrades there. And then also looking at opportunities to provide additional lanes outside of the general purpose lane or a redefinition of a general purpose lane to provide a transit queue jump lane. So essentially what that is it would be a lane that the bus can use, and I'm sure you've seen other applications of this, at the signal that allows the bus to essentially bypass or at least get a jump on the regular vehicle queue that's there. Again, promoting and prioritizing our TART system and our transit usage on these corridors. Phase two, a little longer vision here, but it really expands from that intersection work initially, building this bus only lane in between the intersections on the segments. And then lastly, phase three, we recognize the need for a climbing lane over Brockway Summit. A lot of times we get slower moving vehicles, trucks, transit buses over that summit due to the grade. And so really looking to make sure that we're providing those climbing lanes in that application. Next slide. So to give you some community feedback here, we did ask this question, do you think a bus only lane would work for our region? And you can see both through the virtual workshop that we held, as well as our more technical stakeholders that we engaged with, there was a very positive response with the reversible lane. Next slide. I'm gonna jump into our next focus area, parking management. So the second element of the plan focuses on our town centers, Tahoe City and Kings Beach, as well as some summer and winter recreational areas. So these areas are really where our visitors are attracted to, and therefore we identified the need for strategies to reduce that vehicle load and the vehicle attraction in those areas. We are recommending a paid parking program to be implemented in the town centers, focusing our efforts on the public lots as well as our on-street parking. I will say that, you know, in conversations with the community, you know, the ability to adapt any kind of parking management program that we implement for the public onto private lots is a voluntary strategy or a voluntary application by an owner or an applicant is definitely something that we're open to. So, but I'll say that, you know, the paid parking system really kind of better manages the stay of that vehicle in our town centers, and it acts as a nudge to decrease vehicle usage overall. I'll also mention that it has the potential to generate revenue for us to be used with our alternative mode strategies and mobility, so our transit shuttles, construction of sidewalks, bikes, trails, and bike paths. And then to highlight, our recommendation also includes the residential parking management program be coupled with paid parking. And really, I think what we're recognizing here that, you know, any paid parking system that we develop in those town centers is going to have a dramatic effect on and sort of have spillover effect into our neighboring residential areas in those town centers. So we think it's critical to not only to think about those two efforts together. You know, I do want to also mention that it is important to consider here that this effort on parking management was really generated through a conversation with our business communities initially. And, you know, working closely with both the downtown associations of Tahoe City and Kings Beach, we've, you know, developed those recommendations and received support from both of those organizations. So next slide. Just to give you a little graphical representation here, you know, the area in blue is represented by our paid parking recommendation zones. So you can see here, Tahoe City is on your left, Kings Beach is on your right. Again, the blue zone is the areas that we're recommending a paid parking strategy. The green area is our neighboring residential, and so that is where we would really be focusing our efforts on some type of either permit or residential parking program that we would hope to work with, I think, as part of phase one. The orange areas on this graph, on the left, the orange area in Tahoe City is the 64 acre. We are recommending, and I'll touch on this in the next slide, but we are recommending working on a paid parking strategy for that recreational or that overflow lot. Similarly, on the right, the orange in Kings Beach is our Kings Beach State Rec area, obviously managed and governed by state parks. But again, that that is a perfect example of a paid parking model that already exists in our communities. So next slide. So talking about that recreational component of parking management, we focused in on our high frequency beach attractions here. We have a recommendation for some, you know, again, parking, paid parking strategies at these locations. I know many of these locations are starting or already feeling the heat of summer attraction. So needing and wanting to start a conversation at those points as well to maybe stand up some type of parking management. And I do want to recognize that when we developed the plan, we did take a survey of all the beach attraction areas throughout the basin and really found that, you know, beaches in Placer County are some of the only beaches where it is still free to park and there is no parking, paid parking strategy. So next slide. Again, to give you some community feedback here, we did ask the question of our community on parking management. And again, I think you can see, you know, overwhelming support for that strategy as well. Next slide. So jumping into the third element, the plan includes some initial recommendations on a micro transit or shuttle program. Again, building off of the recommendations that are in the regional plan, we really started to put some detail around how we might implement that here in Placer. And I'm excited to announce that Placer is committed to providing a pilot of this service this summer, and it actually starts tomorrow. So great timing. We have found that, you know, that this you can find information on this on the North Tahoe TMA's website, and I have that here on the slide. So we branded this service TART Connect because although we think it's a great alternative to get downtown or get to the beach once you're in the region, you know, the real bang for the buck on this is the service provides us with a much needed first mile, last mile to get from your house to the TART, the regional TART system bus stop potentially. That we've heard over and over is a barrier for people on reasons why they don't ride the regional service, is that the bus stop is not immediately adjacent or is difficult to get to in, say, you know, a winter period. So we think this service could provide that connection and hopefully incentivizing people to take our regional system. And I will say it's free, so there you go. So the summer pilot will operate, like I said, starting tomorrow all the way through Labor Day, and it can be accessed from 8 a.m. Through midnight. Next slide. So some more feedback here. We pulled the community just to get a sense of where we might have higher demand. And I think the interesting point of this slide and this survey is to show you that we had wild interest in all areas of Placer when we asked this question. And I think the decision for the pilot was really trying to make that connection for our town centers, for the first mile, last mile opportunities, really providing an alternative mode again to usage of that vehicle. Next slide. So talking a little bit about trip reduction here. So the plan acknowledges the need for additional awareness and promotion of just overall trip reduction programs and opportunities for those who live and work within the region. So both Placer County and TRPA have current ordinances or codes related to just, you know, that work commute, that work travel. So therefore, we've decided to team up to roll out the Commute Tahoe program and some potential amendments to both your ordinances at TRPA as well as the Placer County Trip Reduction Ordinance. Really, I think our thought is to kind of dust it off, make sure it's still relevant, make sure that we're building connection and partnerships with the businesses that would be asked to implement it. So, and I'll mention that, you know, the North and South Shore TMAs are also part of that rollout of Commute Tahoe and just the overall discussion, really leveraging them to kind of get out to our businesses and work through those contacts that they have, but also helping us define the right mix of transportation strategies. We think they play a key role here. So next slide. And then one more survey result here. So we polled those who live and work within the region and really found great support and great usage of alternative transportation. So I think this boils down to really the philosophy of, you know, build it and they will use it, or build it and they will come exist here in Tahoe. And so, you know, making sure that we are providing those incentives and providing those opportunities for people that live and work within the community can better access those amenities. Next slide. So bringing it full circle back to the regional transportation plan, we just wanted to borrow this graphic from your plan and show you how the work in the Resort Triangle transportation plan fits into your three buckets of Visit Tahoe, Discover Tahoe, and Everyday Tahoe. So we really feel like the resort plan is moving us forward again, like Michelle opened with, you know, towards implementation of this regional plan. Next slide. So, and I'd be remiss if I didn't circle back and make a connection on BMT. So I do want to take a couple minutes here on this slide just to highlight the efforts of your board in adopting the regional and project level VMT standards back in April, with implementation of, like I mentioned, Senate Bill 743 under CEQA law in California last year. You know, project development in the Tahoe Basin portion of Eastern Placer, as well as El Dorado and the city of South Lake, was suddenly subject to this overlapping environmental review standard, one under your code of ordinances and one under our CEQA requirements. So again, as a result, we have teamed up over the course of the last, what, year and a half, and you know, really looking to try to minimize the need for two different studies, two different metrics, and potentially two different conclusions under BMT. So I am happy to say that our Board of Supervisors adopted the East Placer BMT framework under CEQA review at our board meeting yesterday. Our next steps really include a focus on BMT mitigation and implementation through our public and private partnerships. We're currently updating our transportation fee program, which, as some of you know, has been predominantly focused on vehicle capacity needs. This update will incorporate funding for all modes of travel, focusing heavily on our big lever, and that is transit. We're also, I will say, exploring the possibility of a VMT mitigation bank or program, and we are in current communication with Melanie Sloan and others on your TRPA staff, trying to coordinate the transportation fee, mobility mitigation fee, and others within the region for project development. Next slide. And then lastly, I'll just wanted to touch briefly on funding. This is a very big topic, but I just want to present this slide and talk about our funding structure in, for transportation in Eastern Placer. As I mentioned, it's very complicated, you know, conglomeration of both state, federal, local, and private sources, as you can see here. So I think the main takeaway here that I'd like to express from this slide is two things. One, just the amount and the number of funding sources that play into the larger implementation of transportation in our region. And then two, really focusing in on the yellow and blue, yellow and red here. First to say that our developments in the yellow are paying their fair share towards VMT mitigation. And then second, to highlight really the need to leverage alternative transportation funding through both public and private sources. So that's those in the red. And so this is just our fee structure, everything on the table. Here is a graphic for you. So with that, I greatly appreciate this opportunity to really showcase our work related to transportation in Placer and to provide you with the examples of regional transportation plan implementation.
Great. Thank you so much, Stephanie. I really appreciate it. That is really insightful. It's creative. It's very interesting. I'm looking forward to further developments. And we have a number of comments and some questions. But before we get there, I was hoping that I could just give Cindy an opportunity to say hello to us and talk to us a little bit about this item.
Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it. Well, Stephanie has done an outstanding job coordinating with all of our staff and all of our stakeholders on this plan, and we're really excited about it. And even though it was late yesterday afternoon, Stephanie, we did approve the VMT. Even though we're still all a little mind-boggled with VMT strategies through the process, I tell you, educating our board as with the TRPA board, it's a lot. It's very technical analysis, and how we are varying a bit from TRPA in that our trips have to account for longer distances than TRPA's do. So our standards are a little bit different. Other than a lot of gratitude to Stephanie, I think some of the challenges that we face as public officials in implementing sections of this, especially as it relates to parking, is hiring adequate enforcement staff. I think that the community is ready for some paid parking and residential parking permits, but we've got to be staffed up and ready to go, and that this is basin-wide, as you all know. Wherever we push them out of, they will find another spot. And so that's probably, to me, one of the more challenging public policy side issues. The projects themselves will be challenging. We need to raise funds. Obviously, we have hope that we'll find regional revenue and can continue these pilot programs on an ongoing basis for MicroMass Transit and actually expand it, because we have zones right now, but already we're getting requests. How do I get between zones? And they want to go direct from Tahoe City to Kings Beach without having to change vehicles and that sort of thing. And we can't accommodate that for this summer. But we're very excited what we will learn and how we will be able to move it forward. And as Stephanie mentioned, working on that mitigation bank so that, you know, transportation really takes regional solutions. And when we try to implement the mitigation fees just project by project, it's going to be very challenging and time intensive for the project proponents. Where as a regional solution, if we're able to implement that and bank opportunities, the county can then guarantee that funding moving forward and I think be more comprehensive in our approach. So looking forward to those discussions as well. But again, great kudos to Stephanie and the team for pulling this all together and getting it through.
Yes, thank you so much, Cindy. I appreciate it. Now I have a number of questions and comments, and I'm just going to take them in order of the way they've come in on the chats, and then we'll go to people who want to chime in. Shelley, please.
Thank you, Mark. Kudos, Stephanie. That was a great presentation, and my compliments to Placer County for moving forward with these initiatives. But I did have a question, and maybe I was just, I wasn't seeing the illustration properly, but when we were talking about the reversible bus lane, it looked like there was a raised median to the right of that lane. How can it be reversible if you've got a permanent improvement like a raised median? Or is there a specific point of entry into that, like a, you know, like a carpool lane?
Yeah, great question. Great question. So the example that I showed is really probably more of an urbanized setting. Thanks for that. Yeah, more of an urbanized setting in Sacramento. You know, the I will say that the raised median concept is also a, would be a challenge for Caltrans for snow plowing as well. So, you know, I think just a lot more conversation and detail needs to go into, you know, how we implement that. That was really meant more intended to just be an example of implementation. So, but obviously, you know, we're going to need to adapt that to some type of urbanized development, and we'll work closely with Caltrans on that.
Okay, that's great. Thank you. And then could you give us a general idea of how the numbers break down for the paid parking survey? You know, are the opponents mostly business owners who are concerned about discouraging patronage of their businesses by tourists and locals?
You know, I don't have that at the at my fingertips, Shelley, but why don't I see if I can pull that up and get back to you on that.
Be great. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Shelley, for your questions. Bill.
Thanks, Mark. Shelley, it's nice to see you. I appreciate your year and a half, along with the rest of your team, to work with TRPA staff on, I was supposed to take a month or two off, but the VMT standards that we were working on, it was very helpful, I think, for us to have Placer County working with us. And I also think, if you could back up the slides to the horrible pie chart that you showed of all the different funding sources, this is what has driven Jim Lawrence to get a resolution out of the Nevada legislature. And what we're really working on is two states and a basin with all our local governments, is how do we deal with the funding of what we really need to carry out what you have approved, and what is a part of our $2.7 billion regional transportation plan. And if you look at that, I mean, it's very difficult to get the capital improvement funding to do a lot of the things we want to do if we're going to try to piece all these little things together. And I really appreciate Cindy's leadership, and also just the county of Placer stepping up and figuring out different ways that to come up with local funding to provide the free pilot this summer for a microtransit to see how that works from the within this you know, our tourist demand economy. This will give us a whole lot of valuable information, but ultimately what we're going to come up with is a recommendation based on our priorities of where our funding needs are. But what we really have to ask of the states and maybe the federal government is, look, you didn't build the Golden Gate Bridge with this kind of pie chart. You came up with a need and you established the fund and you gave the funds up front, and then you paid it off over time, and you paid it off in different ways, but either by selling bonds or you charge people for going across your bridge or whatever. And that's the difference, is for a basin that's basically been set up to protect Lake Tahoe and to address the recreational interests that come into Lake Tahoe. The two states and the Congress have got to come up with a better way for this basin to be treated differently than just another local agency or even a state agency, because what you've done is you've created a bi-state approach. And we're going to need to convince them that we need a shot of infrastructure funds to allow us to start, and then we start paying this off, and then we adapt to how this works, because I don't think we can continue to operate in the kind of incremental fashion that we have in this basin. It's crazy for us to even think that we can. So that's what we're really struggling with now with this bi-state group that we put together. I said, okay, what is it we need? And then how best do we put it together, and how we pay for it? We do it in a way that's fair and equitable to everyone, but it is essential, I think, in order to protect Lake Tahoe and to really make it the recreational place that we all like and enjoy without having, you know, the cars and the traffic just kind of destroy it all for us. So I really appreciated this chart because it really shows the difficulty that we have right now under the current funding mechanism. And again, thank you, Placer County, for the leadership. I think you provide us a good example for us to make the pitch for we're doing what we can, but we need some help. And I appreciate your colleagues on the board, Cindy, stepping up with some of these local user fees. It's great. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Stephanie, do you have any comment to any of that, or we have more questions and comments to come? Did you want to follow up with Bill on anything that he said?
Yeah, I guess just to say thank you. I mean, it definitely acknowledge the patchwork or the challenge of all these funding sources, figuring out where we can get money, how we can put that all together. It is a challenge for every project where we're really trying to develop a funding strategy project by project. And in some senses that makes sense because, you know, transit funding is different from road infrastructure funding. The color of that money changes depending on the application. But I fully appreciate and recognize your comments about a sort of a larger vision and a larger strategy here.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Stephanie. Okay, Alexis, you had a comment.
Well, I would like to reiterate just kudos to Placer County and Cindy and Stephanie. Wow, what an incredible plan you have. And we are embarking on doing some studies this fiscal year, starting in July, for Washoe County on parking and traffic and beautification. And so I will be reaching out to you about the process that you started in 2018. It sounds really comprehensive, and I look forward to seeing that we have a similar plan in place as well in a few years. So thank you for the inspiration. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Alexis. Okay, Jim Lawrence. Jim, you had a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of things. One, I will just add on with the kudos and the appreciation for the leadership of Placer County for putting together this plan. And just all of the forethought that Placer County, you know, uses to put together the plan and thinking outside of the box and really looking towards a vision of what transit and transportation is going to look like, not just in Placer County, but in the basin. So a really great job. And I will confess that I did not read all 439 pages of the resort plan, but I did give it a skim last night, and I really liked the format. I just wanted to mention, I loved how you broke out the priorities and then identified the priority projects, but then I also identified both the benefits, and I think you called it implementation considerations. That really kind of got to more of a granular level of what it's going to take to implement, and I really like that. So great job with this resort plan, and I just wanted to say that. I did have two questions. One is regarding that pie chart that Bill had you bring up. I think, well, first a comment, that's a great chart because it shows the complexity, but also, you know, as a state representative, I think it's really important to highlight all of the work in generating revenue at the local level, and I think that chart does a very good job of that. You know, everybody's in this together and this is how everybody's paying for it, and we need to figure out a better way to do it. But I did notice that each slice of the pie seemed to be very even and equal. I'm assuming that chart is just illustrative of the different funding sources and doesn't actually show exactly how much each funding source goes into transit, or correct me if I'm wrong.
No, you're absolutely right. It was really more meant to be a graphic to show the amount and the amount and detail of the funding. Obviously, if we had a truly represented pie, you'd have a pretty big funding sources with a bunch of little slivers in there.
Right, and it would change from year to year, I would imagine, because some of those sources you know, our grant sources, and they can go up or down. So that's what I thought, but I just wanted to make sure I wasn't assuming anything. And then secondly, and it's been kind of touched on, and Cindy talked about, you know, the zones for the microtransit, and then Alexis talked about Washoe County moving in the direction of coming up with a plan. I know when I talk with our Sand Harbor park rangers, we do get a fair amount of visitors, obviously, from Reno and Carson City, but a lot are also traveling in from California. So I'm wondering, moving forward, what are the thoughts and maybe connecting the different microtransit services or providing microtransit from maybe Placer County over to the East Shore if that was desired?
Yeah, I mean, it's not something that we specifically studied, but I do know that we're open to having those conversations, you know, just providing that benefit as much as we can and moving people around.
And maybe, Jim, I could jump in. I know that that's probably next step, that we want to look at how we connect those. Now that the TBID is passed, we need to go back and find the permanent funding to do that. The company that we are contracting with to provide the MicroMass Transit couldn't staff up to provide all the services that we wanted year one, and we couldn't afford it year one, but by next summer, we certainly should be able to expand and look at connectivity between zones. That would be our goal. But again, it's funding dependent, as you well know, so.
Okay, great. Thanks, Cindy. Yeah, I think that's gonna be the key for particularly sustainable recreation, is to sort of have these places where folks can either park outside of the basin or immediately when they get into the basin, but then have that service to go to wherever they wanna go to recreate within Tahoe. So thanks. Anyway, great job. I really thought it's a good plan.
Right, thank you, Jim. I appreciate it. And I don't see anybody else on the chat. So if anyone else has any questions or comments before we go to public comment, just raise your hand or call out and I will get to you. Again, I think you've heard this a number of times. Really fantastic ideas. Out of the box, I think everybody in the every jurisdiction in the basin should be looking at this to try to better their plan, because there's so much here, but I think everybody could take a little bit from it. And we very much appreciate the presentation. Okay, let me now take us to public comment on this item. If any member of the public wishes to address the governing body, governing board on this agenda item, please raise your hand now and go to webinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff. And I'll turn this over to Catherine to manage the public comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have a few hands raised to make comment on this item. Carol Black, you're unmuted on my end to address the board.
Hi, this is Carol Black. I'm an Incline Village resident, as you all know. Can you hear me okay? Yes?
Yes, we can.
Okay, good. So I wanted to take an additional step here and propose that TRPA consider a collaborative to manage, maximize positive outcomes, and minimize adverse safety and environmental impacts across sort of an expanded corridor approach into overlap areas, and also considering intercepts, connections, and integration with adjacent geographies. I've sent you a written proposal with more detail. TRPA seems well positioned to take on this added scope as a successful convener to address complex issues and develop workable interventions. And I sent some detail suggestions. I think I agree with what everybody else has said. This Placer plan has enormously positive content from what I see, and lots of ideas and examples. And I'm thrilled to hear what Alexis has said about considering some of these approaches as we look at in Washoe County. I sent you two paragraphs of concerns, and I'm just going to highlight a couple. that I think you're all aware of. First of all, this approach today presented touches on a portion of this area, but only as it faces the resort triangle as I read it, and I admit I skimmed it. I didn't read every single line. And it doesn't specifically address tactics for volumes of transit and vehicles coming from, passing through the triangle into adjacent areas, in my case, towards Incline Village and Crystal Bay, and across the California border. That's just an example of an opportunity. It's not meant as a criticism. Significant development is planned or in process along Route 28 between the Route 267 intersection and Crystal Bay Incline Village, as you all know. And I haven't seen, particularly around Crystal Bay, there's multiple developments, multiple boarded up buildings, I assume, waiting for development. And I haven't yet seen a comprehensive plan to talk about what's going to happen to people trying to get through that area, traffic, congestion, or evacuation, just as another example. So, and I've included some additional examples of which you're all very much aware. So I just wanted to put a pitch in right now for some kind of overarching collaborative coordination effort to look at the interface areas, the overlap areas, to really get an integrated, cohesive, across region approach as we move forward. And I appreciate your time and the opportunity to speak. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Carol. Catherine, is there other hands?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Steve Teixeira, you're unmuted on my end to address the governing board.
Thank you, Catherine. Again, members of the governing board, Steve Teixeira on behalf of my role as a transportation activist around the region. Certainly want to second the commendations for Placer County and the work that they've done on this plan. I think what isn't shown and what isn't necessarily reflected in Ms. Holloway's very good presentation is the amount of dialogue that the county has with the town of Truckee and increasingly with Washoe County. Even though this is a Placer County Resort Triangle plan, it clearly involves Truckee. And increasingly, I think with the good working relationship that Supervisor Gustafson has developed with Commissioner Hill, increasingly involving Washoe County. And that kind of regional collaboration is really, really important. I think sometimes on the South Shore, we get a little siloed, so we can be inspired by what's happening in the Resort Triangle. Also, really want to commend Mr. Yates for his comments. Looking at the pie chart, as we all did, this really is illustrative of how crazy transportation project funding, whether it's for infrastructure or transit, can be. And there really has to be the kind of solutions and understanding of that challenge that Mr. Yates described relative to the two states that we're working with here to try to help find a solution to these problems. It simply can't be done with local revenues alone. So again, kudos to the presentation, and we hope to be successful in our collective efforts to find a regional transportation funding solution that is sustainable and can really make a lot of these plans come to life. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. Catherine, anybody else?
Mr. Chair, there are no other hands raised to comment on this item.
Okay, very good. This matter was informational only, so there isn't any kind of a vote. But again, I wanted to thank Michelle, Stephanie, Cindy, for all the hard work that went into this. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Honored to do it. Thanks for the time.
Okay. We will move to item 6B, update on greenhouse gas inventory report and climate initiative. The information on this item can be found on page 105. As a reminder to the public, after staff presentation and board discussion on this item, you may raise your hand in the GoToWebinar and be unmuted by TRPA staff to share your comments. And before we hand this off to Devin Middlebrook, we have Julie Reagan here, and she has some information that she would like to kick this item off with, and we're happy to have Julie with us. Go ahead.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board and the public. I'm Julie Reagan, Chief of External Affairs and Deputy Director here at TRPA. I just have a couple of introductory remarks to tee up this presentation for Devin Middlebrook. You've heard from Devin on previous occasions in relation to our climate and various sustainability initiatives. I wanted to take the opportunity to thank the state of California through the California Tahoe Conservancy for funding the work that Devin will be presenting an overview on. And this is really coming at a crucial time where we are feeling the effects every day of climate change here in Lake Tahoe and all around. And it intersects with everything that we're doing. And so when you look at connecting the dots, I think our last presentation was a really good connecting of the dots between our big high-level policies at the regional transportation planning level, right down into implementation in corridors and neighborhood scale. And that's really what it takes to pull off the kind of epic collaboration for our regional planning initiatives. And Devin will get into more detail about that. I did just want to remind those members of the board who were here several years ago, back in 2014, we won an American Planning Association award, a national planning award for our first sustainability plan, which this climate initiative for the agency is tiering from. And then the inventory of greenhouse gas emissions that Devin will be sharing with you really gets into a much finer grain of detail at the opportunities that we have to reduce greenhouse gases and then to adapt going forward. And in looking at the future in terms of adaptation, just wanted to also remind the board that we have our environmental improvement program, and the tagline that we came up with for this newest update of the EIP was our blueprint for climate resilience. So really taking this further from this conversation with you into more prioritization of how we can harmonize both of our state's aggressive climate goals, as well as all the work of our individual jurisdictions, which have been very active in this space as well. And then what is our right fit at TRPA at the regional scale of connecting the dots and harmonizing all that so that it rolls up into actual action that supports state goals and right down to that local neighborhood level. So that's something that Devin will be touching on and that we'll be bringing back to you for further conversations, whether it be at our governing board retreat coming up in July and as we move this initiative forward. So with that, I will tee this up and give this over to Devin. Appreciate your attention.
Thank you, Julie and Devin. We welcome you to the board meeting today, and we're really interested to hear your presentation.
Thank you for having me, and thank you, Julie, for the introduction. Devin Middlebrook, Sustainability Program Manager here at TRPA for the record, providing an update on the greenhouse gas inventory that was recently completed and our climate resiliency initiative. Next slide. As Julie said, our 2014 Sustainability Action Plan and Sustainable Communities Program was nationally award-winning and really set the goalposts and the goal line very high for climate action at Tahoe. This wasn't the first time that we were working on climate, and it definitely has not been the last. In our bi-state compact and the formation of TRPA, they may not have used the words climate change and sustainability, but everything that that framework lays out for us does touch and advance climate action at the lake. Next slide. Within the 2014 plan and subsequent local, regional, and statewide plans that have been adopted up to today, looking at both mitigation and adaptation, there's a lot of actions going on. On the left highlights the mitigation actions, the actions to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, and there's 184 identified actions in the region. The red bars show the percentage of greenhouse gas emissions by category in the region, and the green dots show where all of those actions are directed. So you can see that our actions do align with where our emissions are at. In terms of adaptation, within the region, there's about 325 actions identified over a broad set of different categories. And many of these mitigation and adaptation actions have been implemented, are currently being implemented, and are being planned for implementation. So we're the region and our partners are very active in addressing climate change. Next slide. So as we continue to advance climate action, there's many new inputs that have come in since 2014 and things that we're responding to make sure that TRPA and the Tahoe region are on the continue to be on the cutting edge of climate action. That includes obviously the greenhouse gas inventory that I'm going to be talking about today. There's additional state mandates. I will just give a shout out here to the state of Nevada for releasing their first ever climate strategy last December. And many of the projects and programs that we work on here at TRPA are in alignment with that strategy. And then regional and local climate plans have been adopted, including the city of South Lake Tahoe, Placer County, and then the California Tahoe Conservancy, along with input from many stakeholders, just released the Tahoe Climate Adaptation Primer, which highlights all of the adaptation actions at Lake Tahoe. And then I do want to do a little bit of a spoiler alert and just note that our 2014 target for greenhouse gas reductions was 15% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2020. And our inventory that I'm about to go over shows that we did meet that in 2018. So just wanted to not bury the good news there that we are working towards and meeting our goals. Next slide. So now I will dive into that greenhouse gas emission inventory. The exciting and innovative part about this emission inventory is we didn't just look at emissions and sources of emissions. We also looked at carbon sequestration on the landscape to start to get a full picture of our carbon cycle here in the region. Next slide. In terms of emissions and carbon sequestration, all of the numbers that I'm going to be talking about on the next few slides are all in carbon dioxide equivalent, which is a metric used to be able to compare various greenhouse gases, apples for apples. So it gives you one number to be able to compare across. And this shows those two different buckets of emissions and sequestration and where those sources come from. Next slide. Here is a highlight of the 2018 breakdown. For this inventory, we did look at 2015 and 2018 emissions and compared those to 2005 and 2010. You can see that the majority, over 95% of the emissions in the region come from transportation and energy sectors. So that's our roadways and our built environment. Within the energy sector, I will point out that natural gas is 56% of that 59% of emissions in energy. And natural gas in 2018 overtook electricity as the number one source of greenhouse gas emissions in the Tahoe Basin. You can see that it is also broken out by jurisdiction, and it's roughly equivalent to each of those jurisdictions' population and land mass within the Tahoe Basin. So there's nothing that stands out there, and we do have boating emissions unattributed to any jurisdiction, but those do make up about 3.6% of our emissions. Next slide. Comparing the 2018 numbers to previous emission years, going back to 2005, as I said, the good news is we are reducing emissions. Emissions significantly decreased between 2005 and 2018. You can see that on the right. I will highlight that wastewater, that 1,000% increase is due to a way that wastewater emissions are calculated, not an actual giant increase in those emissions. And overall, they do make up a very small percentage of the total emissions. I will also note that emissions did slightly increase from 2015 to 2018. So while we are making progress overall, it does show that we need to stay on top of it and we can't let our guard down in terms of implementing projects that reduce those emissions. Next slide. As I've noted, the energy sector from our built environment includes electricity and natural gas. This is also very much linked to the runaway and rampant development leading up to the 1960s Winter Olympics and the ultimate creation of the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency. This inventory used a tool called Urban Footprint to start to model our built environment and what greenhouse gas savings we could have from implementing our regional plan and regional transportation plan by redeveloping development that is in sensitive lands and moving that to compact mixed use and walkable town center. So the purple buildings, the purple darker colors are the older buildings, and it goes to the lighter color for newer buildings. So we start to see that those benefits of the regional plan that we knew existed are in fact there, and local implementers like the Conservancy can start to use these tools to model future property acquisition and restoration projects, not only in terms of their benefits to water quality, but now they can start to model them in terms of their benefits to climate mitigation and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Next slide. As I said, this inventory is the first time we've started to look at carbon sequestration on the landscape. And I will say that this is definitely an innovative approach to greenhouse gas emissions, and there are no set standards for how these are made. So we're really, again, on the cutting edge here. The other thing to note is while our forests, you can see our forests are absorbing a lot of carbon dioxide every year, between 300 to 900,000 metric tons of that carbon dioxide equivalent. We also understand that our forests are very overgrown from years of fire suppression and historic logging. So that isn't necessarily a sustainable or resilient amount of carbon dioxide to be sequestering every year. We really do need to balance forest resiliency and wildfire risk with wanting to have that carbon sequestration on the landscape. And then similar with meadows, there is a lot of uncertainty. Healthy meadows are green, they're lush, they are absorbing carbon, but our degraded meadows, something that we've worked long on here in the Tahoe Basin at restoring, can be carbon emitters. So not only do we get, again, those water quality benefits and habitat restoration benefits from restoring stream environment zones, we also get more climate change benefits and carbon sequestration benefits. Next slide. Just to highlight that piece with the meadows again, you can see here on North Shore, I believe this is up by Moon Dunes Beach. Previously, before it was restored, you can tell that that clearly looks like a carbon emitter with how brown and dirty that area is. And through the Environmental Improvement Program, that blueprint to climate resiliency, you can see that, you know, the healthy, restored, green, lush meadow not only is providing public access, but is sequestering carbon from the atmosphere. Next slide. So when you put this together, you start to have a balance sheet. This is for the year 2018. And you can see that our net balance really is, there's a lot of variability in the data and modeling for carbon sequestration. And as I said, there's no set protocol for how to measure it. So really across the region, we're either a net carbon emitter or potentially a net carbon sink. But I will again highlight the need to balance carbon sequestration with other priorities such as wildfire risk in our forests, and highlight that while carbon sequestration is definitely a very strong tool in the toolkit towards fighting climate change, it's not something that's the silver bullet that's going to solve all of our problems and help us meet our goals. So there's definitely more science and research that's needed locally in the Tahoe Basin to understand that carbon sequestration process, and starting to develop a more rigorous protocol for being able to compare and have balance sheets like this in future years. I will also note that something like this in looking at carbon sequestration was one of the priority tasks identified in the Nevada State Climate Strategy. So we've already shared that with some folks over in Nevada to give them an insight on how we're looking at it. Next slide. So using this inventory moving forward, as I've mentioned several times, there's definitely need for more modeling of climate benefits, including redevelopment and restoration. When you start to put all these pieces together, implementing our regional plan through partners like the Conservancy or Nevada Division of State Lands to remove aging infrastructure in our meadows and stream environment zones, not only has those benefits of removing those emissions, but then when we go and restore that land afterwards, you're then sequestering even more carbon. So you're really getting the complete picture. Some of this science and monitoring needs to be done on the ground. A lot of it is models and averages from other areas. And really we need to go out and do before and after soil carbon monitoring to see what are those actual benefits from carbon meadow restoration projects. then using this inventory to set management priorities. As I mentioned, 95% of the emissions are electricity and transportation, with natural gas taking over electricity. So how do we identify what actions we need to prioritize in order to address where we know those emissions are coming from? And then I would highlight the fact that we do not have a small task in front of us. The next reduction targets identified in the Sustainability Action Plan are a 49% reduction by 2035, and in line with both states of California and Nevada now, the regional goal of net zero by 2045. Next slide. So now we're going to talk about how we get there, and that is our Climate Resiliency Initiative. And the greenhouse gas inventory obviously talked about the mitigation piece, which you can see on this slide, which reduces impacts of climate change by reducing our emissions and lowering potential warming. But adaptation and resilience are equally as important in addressing all of the impacts we know are coming from climate change. Next slide. I just do want to highlight again, and thank you to the Tahoe Conservancy for leading this effort. Over the last several years, they completed a climate change vulnerability assessment for the Lake Tahoe Basin, which helped better model and understand those impacts, such as flooding, wildfire, landslides, disease that are expected or modeled for the Tahoe Basin. And you can see on that slide, I think we were no one was a stranger to the choking effects of wildfire smoke last year across the entire state of California, and what's already turning out to be a very busy fire season. Next slide. When you start to layer that on top of things like our regional transportation plan, you can look at our roadways and the fire risk to those roadways, especially those key evacuation routes, with the red being extremely high fire danger and the green being lower. That's when you start to connect these things like the Resort Triangle transportation plan that you just saw with the impacts of climate, and you can see that 267 is very high fire danger. So how can you develop those transit priority lanes and other improvements to the infrastructure to not only get people out of their vehicles, but also to better help in times of emergencies and evacuations? Next slide. So now I'm going to walk through a series of diagrams that just show you how interconnected all of this is between mitigation, adaptation, and resiliency. And we really talk about adaptation and mitigation in terms of transportation, land use, natural resources, and science. And when those two buckets add up and impact resiliency and build our resiliency as a region, that includes our economic vitality, the health inequity of our communities, the environmental improvement program, and emergency response. Next slide. Zooming in on mitigation, and we really start to blow this up and connect those four main buckets in the darker blue, the transportation, land use, natural resources, and science. Taking our new VMT per capita threshold standard as an example, you can see it in the bottom left off of science. Those gray lines show where everything connects. So not only does the VMT per capita standard connect to the regional transportation plan, it also connects to zero emission vehicles and removing our aging infrastructure, which then leads to natural resource benefits, including increased carbon sequestration and higher water quality within our watersheds and in the EIP program. Next slide. We do the same process for adaptation and resiliency over the next two slides, so I won't go into the details of everything, but this really does highlight how our wildland-urban interface, forest health, roadway design help us adapt to future climate scenarios, as I explained several slides ago. Next slide. And then finally, within resiliency, this is about building capacity. We saw with the COVID-19 pandemic and the region's response through mobilizing recreation partners to have that sustainable recreation and tourism development, and the amount of resources that were deployed to deal with the challenges of the pandemic are showing you the region's resiliency, and the things that we're doing under that program today can help build our resiliency in the future. Next slide. And we're doing this by integrating across our plans. on implementation programs. We don't want to create another plan, another program, another working group. It really, as you saw in those last several slides, it is all about integrations and connections. And that's what we as a region and that we here at TRPA are really good at, is making those connections, collaborating, and bringing the region together. So implementing climate change through our regional transportation plan, regional plan, and environmental improvement program are how we're going to get across the finish line. Next slide. And that is done through, again, that regional collaboration, but it's also done through integration and adaptive management, education, engagement, and equity, and understanding that everyone plays a part and how do we get everyone moving in the same direction towards an ultimate goal, and then using science, data, and monitoring to make sure that we're doing what we need to do and identifying those emerging areas where more action may be needed. Next slide. And then finally, I just want to cover again that adaptive management piece and call on that top line, just call out those bolded points. We use the science of that urban footprint modeling of our aging infrastructure to plan and do code updates and plan infrastructure improvements and infrastructure resiliency, which is implemented through redevelopment, energy efficiency programs, renewable energy, and our key partners like Conservancy and Nevada State Lands and local jurisdictions help us get there. So this really table illustrates all of the touch points within land use, transportation, and natural resources here at TRPA and the broader EIP partnership, where climate change is actively being integrated across those and using the data and science to adaptively manage for changing conditions on the ground. Next slide. And then finally, I just want to highlight TRPA and Tahoe's continued global leadership. We've always been a global and national leader in terms of environmental protection and using transportation and development to find a balance between our built environment and our natural. And really want to highlight that the United Nations has a set of 17 sustainable development goals. And if you're not familiar with them, there's a group of nine there that we really work towards implementing. We also in 2019 were named a top global 100 sustainable destination, one of very few in the United States. And then we work internationally with things like, with groups like Chile Lagos Limpios. And we've been working lately with the Future of Tourism Council, which is 280 plus destinations across the globe that are all working to implement climate action. And the work we're doing here at TRPA and at Tahoe is helping to influence toolkits and help other destinations implement those goals and create plans leading up to COP26 in Scotland later this fall. So with that, I will say, I guess, next slide and turn it over to Mr. Bruce, the chair, for comments and questions.
Thank you, Devin. Wow. That's quite the summary of quite the issues of our time. And I'm very thankful that you brought that to us, bring us up to speed on what it is that TRPA is doing, all the work that we are doing with respect to climate change and all the dots that we have to connect. It's part of just about every issue that we deal with now. Haley, I'm going to go to the chat, and I'm just going to take the chats as they appear. Haley, you mentioned you've got a question and or a comment.
Yeah, thanks so much, and thanks, Devin, for the presentation. That's so much really good information on such an important topic. I was just had a couple questions about the energy natural gas part. I know the state of Nevada just recently found that the transportation sector had overtaken the energy electricity sector as the biggest emitter for the state. So it's interesting to me to see that in the basin, it's still marked as energy electricity and not transportation. So I'm curious to go back to the report and see some of those numbers. And then I'm just making sure that I'm reading the natural gas part right, because natural gas is included in electricity and also broken out by itself. So is that saying that we're counting the natural gas piece for electricity generation, and then that separate line item of natural gas, is that building home heating? Is that where those numbers are coming from?
Yeah, thank you for the questions. On the first one, yeah, I think in both California and Nevada and nationally, transportation is higher than the energy sector, but here in Tahoe, we don't have as much of the freight and transport that the broader states do. I'm less familiar with Nevada's main sources, but in California, a lot of their transportation emissions are coming from the ports. So those ports have an overwhelming influence on that. So just based on our geography and sort of our industry, that's why we have that difference there. And then in terms of the natural gas, yes, the US protocol for greenhouse gas emissions has energy in one overall bucket. So we do break out electricity and natural gas. So on that chart, the 56% natural gas emissions, that's 56% of the 59% overall.
Great, thank you so much.
Yeah, that ratio within the energy sector.
Really appreciate that. Thank you for that clarification. And thanks again for the information. It's super interesting.
Thank you, Haley. I don't see anyone else on the chat. I'm assuming that there might be some other questions or comments. And so I'm going to give you a minute to think about that.
Hey, Mr. Chair, I do have a comment or a question.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks, Devin, for the presentation. And yeah, really good job. Haley asked one of the questions I was regarding the distinction in Tahoe regarding transportation impacts versus energy sector. So I appreciated that answer. I'm curious, Devin, and I know it's still an emerging science on the sequestration side, and I appreciate you sharing your information with Nevada. We do struggle with kind of coming up with calculations, particularly in a basin and range state with the sagebrush steppe and all of that. But and related to Tahoe, I'm just curious, you know, there is you know, there's a lot of opportunities, you know, for the sequestration, but we also have the wildfire risk. And, you know, whether we like it or not, we do a fair amount of pile burning every year, just because we can't chip everything on site. We can't haul everything out of the basin. How much did wildfire risk and our treatments regarding pile burning, how much of that influenced the calculation regarding sequestration?
Yeah, that's a good question. And a lot of the work is very technical, and I'm not afraid to admit that it's totally over my head. In terms of emissions and that bucket of it and what's being emitted, wildfire emissions in the US protocol are considered naturally caused. They're natural emissions. They're not counted as like human caused emissions. The team that did the carbon sequestration, I know they looked at the forest in 2014 and 2018 and grew it forward. So they did take into account forest treatment projects and a lot of the maps you can see where like the Emerald Fire scar happened. They do have that calculated in there and taken out. So I don't know how the like exact emissions from each pile burn were calculated in that, but changes to the forested landscape were able to be captured and enumerated in the report. But I can also follow up with more information for you, Mr. Lawrence.
Yeah, thanks, Devin. I would like some more information. I appreciate the answer. And I know it's still a challenge and it's emerging science, but it does sound like, you know, accounting for wildfire and pile burning was part of the equation. So yeah, maybe you and I could follow up just offline and I can get some more information.
Great, thank you. Great question. Anybody else with questions or comments? I don't see anything in the chat, and so we will now go to public comment on this item. If any member of the public wishes to address the governing board, please raise your hand now and go to webinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff. And I'll hand this over to Catherine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve Teixeira, you're unmuted on my end.
Thank you, Catherine. Good afternoon, members of the board. Once again, Steve Teixeira, regional advocate. Just to underscore what you all understand, but for the record, this is a focused environmental look at another reason why regional transportation and sustainable funding is so important.
We have really important environmental goals here with GHG reduction and VMT reduction. And that's just another reason why we need to really focus down on developing a sustainable regional transportation revenue source. Thanks.
Thank you. Catherine, anything else?
Mr. Chair, there are no other hands raised to comment on this item.
Okay, thank you. So I'll bring it back for one more opportunity. This was informational only. And at this point in time, it's 12:20. I think it's a good time for us to take a 20-minute break. If anybody objects to that, let me know. Otherwise, I'd like to reconvene at 12:40. Thanks. See you in 20 minutes. So we're going to jump right back into agenda item 6C on aquatic invasive species annual program update. Information on this item can be found on page 217. As a reminder to the public, after staff presentation and board discussion on this item, you may raise your hand in the GoToWebinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff to share your comments. At this point in time, I think we've got Dennis. I'm looking at the video here. See if we've got him.
And, I am here.
Oh, I hear him. Good. Dennis, I'm going to hand this off to you and thank you very much for being here.
Oh, my pleasure. We will get started here. Can everyone see my screen?
Yes.
And are you seeing the slides?
We are seeing AIS program update, yes.
Okay, all right. Well, let's get started. Thank you, everybody. It's good to be with you today. I'm looking forward to the next time when we can be in person. But as Mr. Chair stated, I'm Dennis Abaglo. I'm the Aquatic Resources Program Manager for the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency. And today we'll be going over the AIS program, an update since last time we spoke to you over a year ago. So today we'll have a brief overview of the program and an introduction, talking about the program overall, the partnerships we've built, and some challenges and that's led to opportunities over the last year and a half with some really crazy times, obviously. Then we'll dive into a little bit about prevention and some of the new features that we've incorporated into the program this year. And then we'll talk about the number of mussel boats that we've seen already this summer. And then we'll go into control and we'll discuss our action agenda. That's our strategic plan to control existing species. And then look at some of the major projects we're working on right now. We'll do a brief update on the Tahoe Keys, as we'll be back to you later this year. And then we'll conclude with the funding picture, where the program sits from a funding perspective. So just a brief overview of the program. It's a major priority program of the Environmental Improvement Program. The Aquatic Invasive Species Program, you know, deals with prevention, with our boat inspections, control, monitoring, and then education embedded in everything that we do. But it is, as I said, it's one of the highest priority programs in the basin, and it's led by our Aquatic Invasive Species Management Plan. You can see an example of that on the right. It's the federally approved plan signed by both governors and by the TRPA Executive Director, Joanne Marchetta. And it's our plan to control, you know, another program level strategic plan that describes our actions and designates TRPA as the lead agency to implement and oversee the aspects of the program. If the couple pictures on the bottom of that are some of these species that we're concerned about on the bottom right are quagga mussels, species that we don't have that our prevention program has been successful at keeping out. And then on the left there is a picture of curly pondweed, unfortunately a species we do have that our control program looks to exacerbate, that we're trying to control and remove from the lake. And then the program is wildly successful with no new invasions since the program has began. The inspection program began in 2008, but that's because of the partnerships we've built. I think you heard Devin talk about one of the things TRPA is really, really great at and we excel at is building those partnerships, the private-public partnerships that not only surround the environmental improvement program, but the aquatic invasive species program as well, with all of our partners, not only with our major implementers, the Tahoe Resource Conservation District with prevention and control, but the U.S. Forest Service implementing projects now, along with our marina partners, the boating public, our contract divers that do some of the control work, the boating public, and certainly nonprofit institutions like the League and the Tahoe Fund, all critical to ensure that success, along with our local jurisdictions as well. If we don't have their support and buy-in on this program, we would never be as successful as we are today. And I mentioned some of the challenges we experienced and what we're doing to learn from those and create new opportunities to improve. COVID presented unpredictable challenges. And so one thing we learned that we'll talk about here in a moment is that boaters like additional features, additional conveniences. And so we've incorporated that into the program, which I'll talk about in a moment. But also something that was reinforced, not necessarily a new lesson learned, but reinforced that open and regular communication is critical. Just being able to pick up the phone and collaborate or problem solve with any one of our partners is really key to move forward. And so we've established regular attendance at our AIS Marina Association. We're regular participants there. Of course, we have a coordinating committee that meets on a regular basis. And then we are in constant communication with our delegation and the rest of our partners. And then we've also have a new lesson learned that I'll talk about later as well with implementing old techniques in a new way. That's going to save some time and money, actually. So prevention. As I mentioned, no new invasives since the program started. It's been very successful, really considered the model nationally. Other programs throughout the country mimic what we do. And the program works because it's mandatory. All motorized watercraft are required to be inspected before they launch and decontaminated if necessary. We have extensive training with our staff and the marinas to ensure that only inspected boats are launched. And then we have sound protocols that are based on science. And we make sure those protocols are followed with regular training, as I mentioned, but also we check that with a secret shopper program, a quality control program, where a secret shopper goes to all of our inspection stations, all of the marinas on a regular basis, multiple times a year, to ensure those programs are being followed, or I'm sorry, those protocols are being followed to maintain those protections for the lake. The middle picture there, you can see the seal that we put between the boat and the trailer that designate that boat's been inspected or that it's been in Lake Tahoe most recently. So our marina partners know that boat's okay to launch. And with the protocols based on science, for example, we know that 140 degree water is going to kill anything that we're concerned about. And those protocols that we do have in place allows us to be prepared for any invasive species that might be on a boat, whether it's a quagga mussel or a hydrilla, which is a plant species, but whatever the next new invader might be, our protocols will allow us to intercept that before they reach the lake. And then education, critical in everything that the program embodies. And so our website is one of the main tools for education and outreach. Clean, Drain, and Dry. Most of you have heard me say that many times over the last several years, but it is our program mantra. And we not only do we talk about that on our website as to what it is and why it's important, but we tell people how they can do it. And so when they come to this inspection station, Clean, Drain, and Dry, it not only makes our job easier, it presents less risk to the lake, but then it allows for the boater to have a shorter experience at the inspection station and getting on the lake faster. So a new feature, I think something got skipped, but I had an example of our appointment system. That was one of the new things we added. I'm sorry, I thought I had a picture, but it's not coming up. But basically on our website, you have the choice now of making an appointment for our inspections. And that's something we learned from last year. Voters really appreciated the ability to do that. And while it's one thing for me to say that the voters like it, the proof is in the pudding, if you will. With the 2,400 inspections we've done to date so far this year, 60% of those have been through the appointment system. So that's a lot. I never expected us to have that high of a percentage rate. I was thinking 25-30% of the inspections would be through the appointment system, but close to 60%. That's pretty remarkable. And given that there's a $15 convenience fee added to that, that benefit, if you will, of making that appointment for a specific date and time, that goes to show that voters really appreciate that. And that additional $15 convenience fee that the board approved back in December has equated to about $34,000 in additional fee collection this year. So helping our program from a funding perspective certainly is beneficial. And then the picture you see now is another new feature at our Myers inspection station is a gazebo. It's filled with useful information for boaters, not only about invasive species, but safe boating and smart boating practices, along with take care messaging that is throughout the lake, whether it's fire or picking up dog poop or smoking, what have you, different messages that the public can use while they're waiting for their inspection to be complete. And that was built with funds through the Tahoe Fund. So we're very thankful for their contribution for that. And we look to be able to install more of these at our inspection stations in the future. So I mentioned muscle boats. I think many of you have heard the number of boats that we've seen, which is more than at this point last year. Last year we had about 22 total boats, I believe. This year we're at 13. And so it's quite a bit. And so you may ask what we're doing about that. Part of it is that's what we're prepared to do. We have our trainings, our protocols. That's exactly what they're designed to do, is to ensure the inspectors know where to look, and the protocols we have in place for decontamination. We know we're killing these things, but we're also working with our regional partners, both wildlife agencies for the states. We have good coordination with them. When we do find mussel boats, where we coordinate and decide what is the best steps for these boats, whether it's just us decontaminating it, or do we recommend the states then follow up with a quarantine period to ensure those mussels are dead and not entering the lake. But because of our regional partnerships at a Western level, we also are, you've probably heard me talk about the app that we use that tracks inspections and the number of boats that we have in the lake, but our other Western partners utilize this system as well. And so when boats come from, let's say, Lake Mead or Lake Powell, we know they're on their way, that they do exit inspections at those quagga infested water bodies. And so when that boat leaves those reservoirs and they are alerted that they're coming to Lake Tahoe, we get that. So sometimes we also have advance notice that those boats are coming, so we're ready for them when they arrive. But we're also working with them to have a broader outreach, not only with, because we're not the only ones that are experiencing this. Some of our Western partners are also seeing many more mussel boats that they have in the past. And so looking at publications like the Boat Trader magazine, which is for potential boat buyers, taking out ads to alert potential boat buyers that you should do your due diligence, know where this boat has come from, do a visual inspection before you buy it, and do what is necessary to get it inspected and decontaminated before you bring it to a new water body. And then we have significant outreach because of what we're experiencing. We're not leaving any avenue for outreach unchecked. So I mentioned the gazebo that we have that has lots of good information, but we have billboards that we put on the major highways into the region. There you see an example of one that's on Highway 80. We also have one on Highway 50 coming out of Sacramento. But then print ads in local publications and regional publications to alert the boating public of what we do. And then we've taken lots of opportunities to work with our news stations to do news clips, news stories on the prevention program, the mussel issue, op-ed pieces, press releases, and certainly the use of social media with live Facebook events to let the boating public know that these are a problem and you need to do your due diligence and come clean, drain, and dry if you're going to be coming to Lake Tahoe. So we're using all of those outreach methods to get the word out, and we will continue to do so through the rest of the summer. So moving into control, we look to control the existing species we have, like Asian clams, Eurasian water milfoil, and curly-leaf pondweed. The pictures on the middle and the left are examples of some of those techniques. The left is bottom barriers, whether they suffocate or block photosynthesis for Asian clams or some of the invasive plant species. We employ those on a regular basis. And the middle there, looking at diver assisted suction that removes not only the plant, but the root systems and the seed-like structure that curly-leaf pondweed uses to reproduce. It's a hard structure called a turion. So the suction removal helps remove that part of the plant as well. And then Tahoe is kind of the proving ground for innovative approaches like UV light. We've been incorporating that into our treatment methodologies for the last couple of years, learning each time, but that's an example of the boat that's here now, and we'll talk a little bit more about UV light and what we're doing with it this coming summer or this season. But essentially that the UV light works with a certain wavelength of ultraviolet light that breaks down the cell walls and kills the plants. So the control program has our strategic plan known as the Action Agenda. We put that into place last year, but it is a 10-year strategic plan to reduce invasive species by 90%, our existing invasive species, by 90% over a 10-year planning horizon. The plan was intended to start last year. We got a little bit of a head start with doing work last year on that plan, but essentially every location that we've identified as having some infestation of an existing species has some level of activity. So we are addressing every single location that we're aware of, whether it's through a planning process like we have with the Tahoe Keys right now, or active implementation as a place like Meeks Bay, or another project that will be starting this year at Taylor Tillac, or some of the other areas where we're just doing surveillance monitoring where we've achieved localized eradication predominantly on the North Shore. So making good progress there with all those locations being worked on. But that control, the action agenda also provided some recommendations on new performance metrics. Not only do we want to continue to track the acres we treat each year, which is a good level of indication of work and how much projects may cost, but we also want to be able to track regularly how much progress we're making towards that 90% reduction. So looking at overall acres reduced, the number of projects we put into place every year. And so we've formed an ad hoc committee of our coordinating committee to identify new and updated performance measures that we'll be putting into place to track that success. So looking at some major projects we have underway, Meeks Bay, I mentioned. What's exciting about Meeks Bay, not only do we think that we'll be buttoning up this year, but it's part of a likely trend where these are projects that are a phase one of a much grander restoration effort. So Meeks Bay, phase one is aquatic invasive species control and eradication, but then phase two will be more of a broader restoration. So having that first step of a grander restoration is exciting. And the middle picture there is Ski Run. That's an example of another innovative approach that has been implemented here at Tahoe. Laminar flow aeration is a process that has diffusers in the water that provide a consistent level of oxygen from this beneath the substrate all the way to the surface to allow better decomposition of those loose organics or the muck layer, very technical term that we like to use. But that's where these plants get a lot of their nutrients. And so the oxygen helps break that layer down, making it less suitable for invasive plant habitat. It's like any method we use, it's not going to work all by itself. You can see in that picture, there are still some signs of plants. And so we're in the planning process to do complementary work to the laminar flow starting next year with UV light, and then likely bottom barriers and suction removal out in the boating channel itself, lakeward of the marina. And then a picture on the right is an example of a best management practice we've been, again, revolutionizing here in Tahoe with this bubble curtain. 2 years ago, I believe, the Keys property owners, along with support from the League to Save Lake Tahoe, put in one of these bubble curtains on the West Channel that prevents fragments from moving out of the Keys. And now here's an example of one that was just installed in the East Channel just a few weeks ago in the Tahoe Keys. But we also have two on the East Shore, Southeast Shore, at Elks Point Marina, a small private marina that invasive work has been completed, along with another one at Lakeside Marina, where the ones at the Keys are intended to prevent fragments from leaving. The ones at Elk Point and Lakeside are intended to prevent fragments from entering the area we just treated, so protecting that investment. Here's an example of the bubble curtain. It's pretty simple technology. It's hoses that sit on the bottom, providing this wall of bubbles that act as a barrier for fragments to stop that spread. Another major project that will be going underway in August is the Taylor to Lac project. Another big project, actually. This will be the biggest one we've ever attempted at over 17 acres. It's challenging, it's big, it's spreading. It's in a new environment for us, in a wetland environment, so access is very difficult, as you can see the picture here. There's no roads. Normally we boat to these locations, but this is going to be in a marsh and creek system, so the access is a little bit different. But another project that represents phase one of a larger restoration. And this project is extremely critical because of the habitat. It's the Forest Service has reported that the Taylor to Lac area is capable of providing habitat for every native species in the basin. So implementing a successful program project is very, very important, as well as that the Taylor to Lac system is the last functioning wetland in the region. So something somewhat shocking that we learned recently on an executive field tour at the to Lac Marsh a few weeks ago. So another reason why it's really critical to have success on this project. But another opportunity for us where we've learned over the years, the picture on the top there is an example of the barriers we've put in place in other projects, where typically they're about 10 feet by 40 feet with quite a bit of overlap to ensure that we don't have gaps in the treatment area. And so we lose about 30% of the area that these barriers provide. And so what we're doing for the first time at the Taylor to Lac project is now we've bought these in essentially large saran wrap rolls where divers can just unroll. I believe they're about 300 to 400 feet long in length that the divers can just unroll. We limit the amount of overlap that we have to put in place and limit and reduce the amount of labor it takes to put these in place. So with the Taylor to Lac project alone, with the cost savings of materials and labor, we're saving about $1 million on this project. With the price tag of about $3.5 million already, that savings is really crucial. So we have federal funding from Lake Tahoe Restoration Act, from TRPA, but also the Forest Service. And we've just been informed that the Tahoe Fund is providing $100,000 as well from a private contribution from the Merrill Foundation. So we're very fortunate to be able to have that ability to attract local donations for important projects such as this. Another major project that we started last year and we're continuing into this year and beyond is what we refer to as the Keys Complex. This is the area right outside of the channels of the Keys, and it's big. It's over 100 acres. Differences in, or variations in density, so different treatment methods are being employed over the long term, but what we're focusing on now are some of these denser locations near the channels into the Keys themselves, and focusing on those highly dense areas. So this project's a little bit different than other ones we've implemented in the past where we're seeking that localized eradication. Here, we're just trying to keep this infestation at bay and maintaining it from spreading even further while we continue to work on the Tahoe Keys project during that planning process. So it's not only complex because it's big, but because we're in a very high boat traffic area, we've taken additional steps to ensure boater safety because of all that boat traffic that may create conflicts with our divers. Here's an example of some of the work that's been ongoing. Picture on the left, the diver employing the diver assisted suction, and just an example there on the right of kind of a in-process treatment. And then an after shot. This was taken early this spring after some of the treatments last year. So fairly effective. This is early in the spring. So just at the beginning of the growing season, you can see a couple sprouts here that have emerged, but we're continuing that work as we speak, starting on the West Channel this year. So good segue into the Tahoe Keys itself. We'll just do a brief overview of this today, as we're going to be coming back to you in the next couple months with a lot more detail. But for those of you that are new, this is our biggest challenge. It's big, not only as a challenge, but from an infestation standpoint. The Tahoe Keys is about 172 acres of lagoons, channels, and waterways, almost entirely infested with Eurasian water milfoil and curly-leaf pondweed. It's a process that we've undertaken. It's one of the most challenging environmental problems we're facing in the basin, but we knew this would be complicated. The Tahoe Keys Property Owners Association has proposed the use of aquatic herbicides. So not only that being a controversial aspect, just the regulatory process itself is complicated. And so, as I said, we knew that going into this. So we formed a collaborative stakeholder group that is looking at the big picture of what we intend to do here. So we have a transparent process, engaging with the stakeholder committee on a regular basis, but then bringing new ideas to the table. And so while the property owners did suggest to use aquatic herbicides, what the stakeholder committee helped define and is being accepted and proposed now by the Property Owners Association is a test approach that looks at multiple methods. So just testing to see what is best is going to be the best set of methods to treat the overall infestation. So looking at herbicides at a smaller scale, but also incorporating traditional and innovative approaches like laminar flow aeration and UV light, looking at all of those, not only independently, but in combination to find that best combination of tools. As experience has told us, not one tool is gonna solve our problems. We need multiple tools in our toolbox. So that collaborative approach has led to a lot of progress. Last summer, we came to you with the draft environmental analysis. We collected 1.5 million points of data that really helped us understand the existing conditions within the Keys, mainly how nutrients are cycling through that system, and that essentially the nutrients are coming from the plants themselves. So the best way to deal with that is to deal with the plants. And what that environmental analysis has revealed is that with careful planning, upfront protections, good mitigations, adaptive management, monitoring, that all of the potential impacts that were identified can be reduced to less than significant. So we're excited to know that the analysis has been detailed to give us that ability to have confidence that whatever level of project is approved will be a successful test to help us understand what the grander treatment methodologies will be. And I mentioned some of the monitoring that's associated with that. Right now, we've submitted aspects of our monitoring plan to the Tahoe Science Advisory Council. So not only has a monitoring plan been developed, but now it'll get really critical scientific review to ensure that that monitoring is detecting anything, but also letting us understand the effectiveness of whatever treatments are approved. So some of the next steps, as I mentioned, we'll be coming back to you later in the summer, but We are working on those monitoring plans, and the draft permits from Lahontan will be available for additional public review and comment later in the summer. And the agencies have committed to coming back to our respective boards in January of 2022 for an approval of some level of project. So stay tuned, and more to come on that. So what are we doing in the meantime? As the process continues, we are not taking any opportunities for granted. And so we received a lot of feedback from the public during the comment periods that more UV tests should be employed, and we are doing that this summer. We are continuing the work at Lakeside Marina, but in addition to that, we are adding 5 acres of test treatments of UV light within the Keys. The map here on the right shows those locations at about 5 acres in total. And so that's a 400% increase in test treatments that have been previously employed. Because it's an emerging technology, there's lots of things to learn, and we continue to learn. The picture here on the left is an example of one of the modifications that are being implemented this year. So the UV light array can angle or articulate, so it can address an angled bottom and have a better ability to be effective with those varying bottom conditions. And then here's that picture of the UV light boat. It's here in Tahoe, that's at Lakeside, and we expect treatments to be starting July 7th, so just in a couple weeks. So we'll close with the funding of the program. We've had a good success of maintaining funds and creating or obtaining new funds. That success has bred success, if you will. Not only have we faced challenges with funding cliffs, if you will, but working with the states and our federal partners to provide funds not only through the general fund, but through grants at the state level, and certainly our federal funding partners with the Lake Tahoe Restoration Act, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Army Corps providing funds. We are confident that we'll be able to continue that success with obtaining more funds. For example, when our funding through Fish and Wildlife and the Lake Tahoe Restoration Act first started, we were at about $3 million. That has been increased to $4 million. And many of you are probably aware that reauthorization of the Lake Tahoe Restoration Act has been introduced by Senator Cortez Masto of Nevada. So we're confident that that will move forward. But looking at our other implementers now being able to do projects, as I mentioned, the Conservation District that has been doing projects for years, but the Forest Service implementing projects, and continued funding from nonprofit sources like the League and the Tahoe Fund are critical to maintain that success as well. But state funding, the map that you see there is an example of design plans at a 30% level. We have funds from the license plate grant through the state of Nevada to build 100% design plans for a permanent inspection station on the Highway 28 corridor. Permanent inspection stations are one of our biggest goals for the prevention program for a long-term perspective. And so having that ability to put those plans in place and then seeking additional funds to build and construct those sites are on our radar. And certainly funding to maintain our staff. Having that talented staff is critical to the success. And if you recall back in December when we did the fee schedule, we committed to coming back to you after a season's worth of the new fee schedule in place, so we can do a better assessment of where we stand with prevention funding. And we'll be doing that towards the end of the year after the season is complete. And then lastly, with our action agenda, that ambitious goal of 90% reduction in plants that has about a $75 million price tag over that 10 years is about $7.5 million a year. And we're more than halfway there with $4 million in federal funds and some of the other funds we have been receiving. We're confident that we're on the right path to achieving that goal. And I'll just close with thanking our team. We have a fantastic team, not only here at TRPA, but with all our partners. A lot of hard work, but a lot of good success. And we have a plan for the long-term vision for the program. And I'm confident that we're going to maintain that success. And thank all of you for your continued support for the program. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you so much, Dennis. And I know with the kind of work and the detail and the protective nature of what it is you do, you don't get a lot of sleep. So we thank you for your great attention to protecting Lake Tahoe.
Thank you.
I have a number of questions and comments. So again, I'll take them in order. Wes, I know you have a question.
Yes, and thank you, Mark. Dennis, years ago, not years ago, a couple of years ago when I was first appointed to this board, I was privileged to be invited with a group that inspected the Tahoe Keys by water and saw the different mitigation strategies that were in use at that time. Is there a possibility that for the newer members of this board who did not have that opportunity, that we could have another outing, as it were, so that we could get them back out on in the Keys and to see what's actually happening on the ground?
Yeah, thank you, Wes, for mentioning that. We did that the last couple years, and I think they were very helpful to show and demonstrate the problem. And so, yes, that is on our plan to incorporate additional field trips this summer.
Thank you.
Thanks, Wes. I appreciate it. We also have a question from Shelley. Shelley?
Okay, Dennis, brace yourself. No, I'm not going to ask you about muscle dogs. That's a conversation for another day. But I was curious, you mentioned under the control action agenda that we need $7.5 million a year long-term, and that would afford us the ability to reduce invasive plant species by 90%. What about the other invasives?
So I'm sorry, the 90% was for all invasives.
All invasives. That would include Asian clams and, okay, warm water fish, crayfish, and so on. Okay.
Yep.
Okay. And then prevention focus, the long-term prevention focus, having permanent inspection stations. You know, I haven't actually had the chance to watch one of these inspection stations in action, but I assume that in a perfect world, these permanent stations will have multiple lanes, because I can imagine during a busy summer day, especially if you're taking reservations, if you've got existing boats that arrive unannounced in the queue, do you move the equipment, the decontamination equipment, if it needs to be decontaminated to accommodate people with reservations? How do you coordinate that?
So the way our, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead, I'm done.
Okay, the way our stations are configured currently, we do have two lanes at two of our stations, both at Myers and Spooner. So one is dedicated for the appointments and the other is dedicated for the traditional walk-ups that we've had for the history of the program. So we already have that in place. The Alpine Meadows inspection station this year actually has four lanes. Since we weren't able to open the Truckee station this year, that equipment has been moved to the Alpine Meadows inspection station. So that has four lanes, two of which are for appointments, two of which are for the traditional walk-up. But the biggest benefit for permanent inspection stations is not only that confidence in the program that demonstrates that we're here to stay, but there's a lot of work that is necessary to set those stations up and decommission them every year. We take a month on either end of the program or of the operating season, or the summer season, I should say, to get those up and ready. We have to rent those spaces or get permits for them. We have to rent office and other needs there. Also bringing water to the sites and taking the water away, a lot of logistical issues that would be solved if we have permanent inspection stations that would allow that infrastructure to be already put in place.
And that would include being able to heat the water to 140 degrees on site.
And we can do that currently, but we can do it more efficiently if we had a permanent station with
okay,
built-in.
I'm assuming you have more than one decontamination unit, right, per station?
Correct. So Myers and Alpine Meadows are our two busiest inspection stations. Myers has one decontamination unit, but it can handle two boats at the same time. Where Alpine has that same system, but we have two of those, so we can handle four boats at once. And Spooner, because it's a little bit smaller of a facility and we don't have the ability to have those larger decontamination units, we have trailered units that we've been using since the beginning of the program, but we have multiple ones there. So we can also do two boats at the same time at Spooner as well.
Okay, great. Thank you, Dennis. Good work.
Sure. Thank you.
Thanks, Dennis. I appreciate it. Okay, Bill.
Hi, Dennis. Excellent report. Thank you for all your good work. I appreciate what you had to say to Shelley. I guess I have a question. Is that when we use divers out in the lake to suction that off, I assume that there must be some boat or something that accompanies it. How do we protect the diver?
So the divers have a boat that they work from, and certainly they employ regular safety protocols with signs and buoy lines. But because of some of the circumstances in some of the projects we're working on now, where there's higher boat activity, we've taken additional steps to prevent situations from occurring. Unfortunately, sometimes that still happens, but with the Keys specifically, it's a high boat traffic area. We've alerted all of the tenants within the marina, some of the tour boat operators, fishing charters, things like that, and certainly the rental boat company, to alert them that we have divers in the water and to inform their renters of the case, providing them with maps of the area, and then also having our TRPA boat crew do regular check-ins with the team on a daily basis, coordinating with law enforcement when necessary, and a check-in with the Coast Guard every morning. We have radio controls or radio communications, not only with the TRPA boat crew, but with the Coast Guard station up in Tahoe City, checking in with them on a regular basis.
So that sounds quite extensive, but despite that, we've had a couple of incidents this year. Is that what happened?
Boaters coming too close. All the education in the world sometimes isn't enough. And so taking those extra steps to coordinate further with law enforcement, this is a bigger issue lake-wide than just the invasive species divers, but convening and collaborating with our partners, this is not just a TRPA issue. This is all of the agencies concerned about the safety of not only our divers, but the boating public, coordinating a larger group to discuss that further and finding additional solutions. But we're also following up with the rental company because the information that we have suggests that those incidents are from boat renters. And so getting the information from the rental company to coordinate and follow up with what TRPA can do from a violation procedure. But then, as I mentioned, having that grander coordination with all of our partners to discuss this more universally.
Yeah, I think, I was out there on the boats when we were doing primarily educational work as we just adopted the shoreline regs to make sure people are in the no-wake areas. We had an issue with the fact that we wanted a no-wake area for Emerald Bay, but we couldn't get enforcement on that entrance. I think that should be looked at. But I'm really concerned that in those situations where we have, we have divers voluntarily cleaning up the lake as part of a Tahoe-funded program on the lake, and then we have this. This kind of situation for our aquatic invasive species program. I really hope we pull together a good group to meet with law enforcement about this. We really need, this is an important public safety issue. And I think we need to ratchet this up a bit. I know Mark wants to do something about this too, but I certainly would contribute. I joke about my going on boats, but I really think that We have, unfortunately, a bit of a party crowd out there that gets to Lake Tahoe and just thinks all bets are off. And I think through the discussions we had last month about kind of how do we educate the recreational public to what's going on at Lake Tahoe, but also we need some help with law enforcement. And we're gonna need help with law enforcement when we start talking about parking management issues and other things that we wanna do. And I think we need to improve our the cooperation we receive. So anyway, I appreciate your comments about that. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
Thanks, Bill. Okay, looking to Jim Lawrence.
Yeah, thank you. And thanks, Dennis. Excellent presentation as always. I'm always so impressed with the job you do and in this program. I do think it's a national model. Hey, I'm just curious, you mentioned during your presentation that we weren't able to get the inspection station open at Truckee, I think is what you said. I forget the reason for that. I'm just curious, why do we did not get that open, and is there plans to get it open in the future?
A couple reasons. One, it was a challenge with where we were located. What we've learned since we last operated, that area was partly on tarmac, and so FAA had issues there with our being there, even though we were far away from any type of aviation activity. There was concern there, and then also from a funding perspective, we need to find ways to reduce costs and being able to double up, if you will, at our Alpine Meadows inspection station, which is still within a reasonable proximity to the Truckee area, being able to handle double the capacity, if you will. So primarily from a funding in order to save funds, but also because of some potential conflicts with the Federal Aviation Administration.
Thanks. And I guess that highlights the importance of having a permanent location for these places so we can make sure that those conflicts don't arise. I was also curious. So it was a funding issue. I was wondering, been reading a lot of reports and talking to a lot of folks, not necessarily in the basin, but coming out of COVID, the difficulty in hiring people for various jobs. And I was curious if that was an issue for getting inspectors, if that was a challenge coming out of COVID.
It's been, unfortunately, a challenge for the last few years. Housing costs are high. We need to have competitive wages in order to have folks be able to maintain a residence or some sort of living here in Tahoe. And so throughout the years, we've addressed our wages. And so some of the fee schedule adjustments have been in response to that. And as I mentioned, with the new fee for the appointment system, the convenience fee associated with that, we'll be able to take a harder look at the funding picture at the end of this season, after some of those changes have been incorporated, to see where we stand and make a better assessment on what's needed after we complete this boating season. But that's certainly been a challenge, regardless of COVID, unfortunately.
Great, thank you, Dennis, and thanks, Jim, for the questions. I do have Wes, who would like to add to the conversation regarding Bill's concern. Wes, would you like to take a moment to explain?
Yeah, thank you. Bill, listening to your comments took me back a few years where for 15 years I was ran the patrol boat for Douglas County on Lake Tahoe. And I can assure you that when local law enforcement is aware that there are divers in the water, they take special care to patrol those areas to make sure that diver's flag is respected. And number one, when we find somebody violating that, the citation is very expensive. So it's a lesson hard learned. And if we have repeat offenses, handcuffs can be used in certain circumstances and have been used in the past. So if law enforcement is made aware where we have divers in the water and whatever jurisdiction it is, because I know Placer and South Lake Tahoe and El Dorado and Douglas work quite well together. Washoe's boating program was just getting underway when I left our program. I was only there for 15 years, and Washoe's program was pretty much volunteers going out there that were sheriff deputies on their days off. But so I would assume that the program is much more aggressive than it was. I hate to say back then, but that dates me a little bit. But I assure you, Bill, when law enforcement is aware that there are divers under the water, they pay close attention.
Thank you, Wes. Yeah, we've had good coordination with law enforcement when the project's been active, and so they have come out and done routine checks, and then also just verifying that the safety components that the divers regularly employ, with the additional protocols we're putting in place with having an extra boat to run interference, if you will, to try to keep boaters away as well. So the El Dorado County Sheriff has made a few visits to check in on our divers.
Okay, this has generated some discussion here. So Bill would like to say a few words, and then Shelly would like to add something as well. So we'll just go in that order. Bill?
I'm sorry, I didn't hit my button. Wes, I really appreciate you responding because I was thinking of you as I was saying this. My concern is that having been out there and watching us try to deal with the question of the entrance to Emerald Bay, in which we adopted regulations to make that a no-wake area. And there was a 15-mile-an-hour buoy out there that the El Dorado Sheriff basically decided that was what the rule was. And it makes it really difficult for us to, as TRPA, to adopt shoreline regulations and not get support from local enforcement. And the rationale is the same. It's not we're not trying to ruin someone's fun. There's a lot of little plastic yellow kayaks that are going out to the island back and forth on a very busy time. And all you need is one speeder, maybe had a few too many beers, didn't think about it. It's kind of is off. He just out there having what he thinks is a good time, and he plows right through the middle of those folks. That's what prompted us to adopt, based on the work of the group that we put together for shoreline regs, to say, yeah, Emerald Bay should just be a no-wake area. And so I would encourage you to work with the chair and maybe staff of how we can reach out and start a dialogue that we really need help on implementing some of our shoreline regs. And I do appreciate the fact that you confirmed what goes on, because I was surprised that we had divers, that there was an incident out there. Because I recall when I lived in Monterey, we had all the, when the divers are out there in the kelp beds, there are all sorts of flags out there and boats with flags on it to prevent, you know, big boats from going into that area. So it's just, there are just other areas. I think I would really love to have a dialogue with law enforcement on how we can assure public safety out there. And we're getting pushback from the league directors in our board-to-board call about the lack of enforcement out in the lake. And so I'm sensitive to it right now and think we might need to open up a constructive dialogue.
Okay, thanks, Bill. And Shelley, before you jump in, Marcia, I just want to make sure that with respect to the agenda, which is really focused on AIS, whether or not this, I just need a little bit of guidance with respect to getting into no wake zones and shoreline related, you know, conditions and that type of thing.
Well, the aquatic invasive species item is an informational item. So it seems that there would be some latitude to discuss these because this is an activity that's related to that. But okay. I recognize your sensitivity to making sure that we don't stray too far beyond that topic.
Okay. So Shelley, I think you're next up.
Yeah, okay, well, I'll try not to stray too far off course. Dennis, I'm assuming that you and other members of TRPA staff are aware that the Carson City Sheriff's Department will have a boat in the lake this season? You are?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Shelley. Sue?
Thank you. I just want to respond to Bill's comments. I've had many conversations with our sheriff's department, and it's their belief that Emerald Bay is controlled by the jurisdiction there, which is El Dorado County, and they've never agreed to the no wake zone because of the issue with the bigger boats needing more power to be able to get around there. So basically, if you do a no wake zone, you're taking out all the tour boats, everything, not just the smaller boats that have infractions. And so there is a discussion that needs to be had again. And you know, I'm happy to help be a part of that and figure out what we need to do. But it goes beyond just the safety of the kayakers. There's a larger picture out there that needs to be discussed when we talk about creating a no wake zone, which El Dorado County does not enforce because they don't. I recognize that.
Okay. It looks like John, that you have a question. Go ahead.
I do. Similar vein, I'll make a tie back to AIS, Dennis. Question. With these the rental boats and just the increase in, you know, tourism here in the last year and a half, are you A, seeing an increase in boat traffic on the lake, and B, is there a documented correlation between the spread of AIS and boat traffic that you've seen?
You know, overall, the boating activity we feel is increased starting with last year. Not necessarily the number of boats that we've seen, but the number of launches. What we hear from our marina partners last year, every day was like 4th of July. So we're aware of that. And certainly there is a potential to have those boats spread existing invasive species. That hasn't been observed from a one-year standpoint, but we have regular monitoring where we are tracking our invasive populations, as well as the shoreline fee that added an additional portion of a fee from the inspection sticker to allow for additional funds to go towards monitoring and treatment projects because of that potential. But certainly that's something on our radar, and we have mechanisms in place to track it and respond. So one of our major aspects of control is rapid response as well, and having the ability to do that, which we do every year, where we hit spots that we know we've had previous treatments in place, but also looking at new locations where we can respond quickly before they get out of hand, which they're much easier to keep under control at that point when they're small. And then also partnering with organizations like the League to Save Lake Tahoe with their citizen science program with Eyes on the Lake, where they train recreators to identify potential new locations of existing species. So another opportunity for us to respond quickly.
Great. Thank you so much. I don't see any other chat. But if anybody else has a question or comment, feel free to chime in right now. I don't hear it, but I think, Dennis, we're going to go to public comment. And in advance, I just want to thank you for, again, your program and for bringing it to us and sharing the successes and the challenges and the plans going forward. So thank you.
Thank you. And the support of this board has been phenomenal, and we really appreciate that.
Thank you. Okay, we'll now go to public comment on this item. If any member of the public wishes to address governing board on this agenda item, please raise your hand now and go to webinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff. And Catherine, I'll let you manage the public comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are no hands raised to comment on this item.
Okay, so we'll then deem public comment closed. If there is any further discussion on this item, please send me a chat or say something at this point, because we're moving to the next agenda item. Item number 6D is the issuance of the final 2019 threshold evaluation. Information on this item can be found on page 219. As a reminder to the public, after staff presentation and board discussion on this item, you may raise your hand in the GoToWebinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff to share your comments. At this point in time, I'm going to hand it over to Ken Kasman. He's on with us right now. I see him. And we're thankful that you are here and looking forward to your presentation, Ken.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the board. Good afternoon. As you'll recall, we presented the draft threshold evaluation to you in March, and we're back today to bring you the final evaluation. And really, this is, as we talked about at that time, the culmination of a digital transformation of the format of the report. And we've added some incremental information to the dashboard. A summary presentation that's available at the homepage, as well as an interactive story map that allows you to sort of walk through the results that I'll walk through again today at a very high level. But we really appreciate the opportunity to walk through this evaluation with you. As we talked about before, this is the seventh comprehensive evaluation of our threshold standards since they were adopted. And, you know, we are seeing, based on the adopted standards, incremental progress towards achieving our goals. You know, the vast majority of our standards are in attainment, and the vast majority of them are either stable or improving, which is really the goal for many of them. But we are seeing the impacts of climate change, as we talked about last time. And so, you know, we want to balance the two, and I'll spend a little bit of more time at the end of this presentation talking a little bit about where we go, you know, from here with our thresholds. Next slide, please. The we again discussed in March, the vast majority of the standards, 79%, are in attainment from this evaluation, and that's up from about 75% in the 2015 threshold evaluation. And again, about 23% of our standards we were unable to evaluate, so about 23 that either because of a lack of a clear target or because of inadequate information or insufficient information to be able to make a determination, we did not reach determinations on. But the vast majority are both in attainment, and we're seeing an incremental improvement in that number, both in the number of standards that we report on in this evaluation, as well as the number that are in the percentage that are in attainment, as you can see from the 2015 report. On the next slide, again, looking at those evaluation attainment changes between the 2015 and the 2019 evaluation, the vast majority are sort of staying in the categories and in the attainment calls that they were in. So 85% of our standards really did not change from the 2015 evaluation to the 2019 evaluation. You can see those at the top of the slide here. The ones that did move, most of them actually moved into attainment. So we saw seven standards across air quality, fisheries, noise, wildlife, and veg that actually moved into attainment. And as we talked about last time, there were a number of standards that we were through improved monitoring and additional information, we were able to report on this go round that we didn't report on in the past. And 9 of those that were not evaluated previously were deemed in attainment for this evaluation. One standard, EVMT, obviously was not evaluated because of the process that was underway to update that standard. And we had one standard that moved from attainment to non-attainment, and we talked about that last time, our threshold standard for Tahoe Yellowcrest, which is so dependent on lake level. And because of the high lake levels during the period in which our evaluation covers, that standard was deemed out of attainment because the populations had dropped because of lake levels. Next slide, please. Looking now at trends, and again, we talked about this before, 96% of the standards are stable or improving. And again, in our system, the vast majority of our standards are looking at that stability. We want to achieve and maintain a certain level, and then and so for standards to be improving or maintaining is really the goal. And so here we also see again both the raw number of standards that are both improving and remaining stable are we're seeing that increase from the 2015 evaluation to the 2019. From the adopted standards, from the standpoint of our adopted standards, we are seeing that incremental change and that incremental improvement that we're really after for our goals. Next slide, please. So this slide, again, now looks at trends and those longer term trends. The vast majority, like we said, 51 standards that were evaluated were little or no change. The ones that are improving, we had several in air quality and water quality, 3 standards in soil, fisheries, and wildlife, and 2 standards in our scenic category. The 3 standards, and again, we talked about these in March, 3 standards that are declining. The highest 24-hour average highest 24-hour measurements for a particulate matter, and again, this is related to what we're seeing that frequency and intensity of wildfires and the influence of that wildfire smoke coming into the basin really driving those highest measures to be out of attainment, even though the average measures for particulate matter in both of these cases were actually in attainment. The other standard that is declining is for primary productivity, and again, this is a measure of biomass that relates to particularly deep water, in this case, deep water plants, and it's something that the Science Council is investigating for us because we're trying to get a better handle on the trends for our deep water plant communities. Next slide. Presented both to the governing board in March. We also presented to APC twice now, and we also presented on the threshold evaluation to the Tahoe Interagency Executive Steering Committee. And in those presentations, we received a number of comments that I would say fell into 2 categories. First was about questions about how we were going to document this evaluation. With the change and transition to this digital format, a lot of questions about how you maintain that record. And so I wanted to spend a couple minutes talking about what we've developed in order to do so. So when we talk now here today about this final evaluation, what do we mean? Well, what we developed, what we're looking at here on this slide is actually one of our indicator pages, in this case, the measure for carbon monoxide. But for each standard on that upper right-hand corner, there's an opportunity to click into more detail that is in our data center. And when you click that button or that link, you'll go to this next page, which shows the historical evaluations that are in our system here, which is 2011, 2015, and now the 2019 evaluation. And at the very bottom of these pages, there are static content. And what we've worked with our technology partner in doing is to basically snapshot all of the content of these pages and of the evaluation here on this page. And so at the very bottom on the next slide, you'll see that we actually here have created a public draft, which is the version that was adopted, presented to you in March. And as soon as we wanted to provide that opportunity for feedback at this meeting, but once we conclude and we receive your recommendation and instruction to issue the final report, we will publish the final evaluation, which will incorporate any changes that we've made since the dashboard went live in March, and snapshot each of those pages in perpetuity. And the plan here is that between evaluations, as we've talked about, we'll be able to present more real-time information on the Threshold dashboard. And as we get updated information, as we find typos, and as new environmental improvement projects come online that we want to link to our thresholds, we will update that content on the dashboard. But here at the bottom of each of these pages, we will preserve the final and the draft content for the 2015 evaluation in their entirety as they are today. And so we wanted to just sort of show this off because I think it's a really neat way to both preserve that content, but allow for real-time updating through the process. The other key area that we got comments from and that we got questions at the various public forums on the next slide were really related to process and related to how we're going to move forward. And so, you know, we've talked a lot with you about, you know, that the four-year evaluations are really designed to kickstart the adaptive management cycle and the adaptive management process that we have. And we recognize this need not only to get back to our threshold updates, but also to accelerate them. The existing standards, as you all know, were mostly adopted in 1982 and, you know, based on science that's 40 years old. It was the best science at the time, but in the intervening years, you know, they really no longer provide meaningful guidance to both our programs and to management and are no longer connected to science. And so because the thresholds are the desired outcomes for the region, there are shared environment goals and there are aspirational goals for the region, we've let our plans really get ahead of the goals. And we talked about this, you know, a couple of months ago when we were adopting the VMT standards. And so really it's about getting back to our threshold update and, you know, really recognizing, you know, climate change is upon us across the West and in Tahoe. You know, our air and water quality temperatures are at all-time highs. In fact, you know, we've already seen record temperatures in the basin recorded this year, and most likely next week we're going to see another round of record highs. Thunderstorms are critical fire danger, and we've already seen fire starts that thankfully, you know, because of the quick and effective responses from our vigilant, you know, firefighters have been controlled. But you look at all of those data points and realize that our evaluation and the thresholds themselves are not responding to these challenges of climate change. The evaluations are a tool for shifting our resources, for identifying priorities and driving projects in the EIP. And we need to bring the threshold standards up to practice with best science, the best information, and the adaptive management systems that drive towards these changes. And as Julie mentioned earlier, you know, the EIP is really setting the blueprint for climate resilience in their project planning and in prioritization. Devin mentioned, you know, the integration and connections throughout those programs. And so, you know, really it's as we start thinking about the threshold update and getting back into these areas, you know, it's not about weakening our standards. It's about acknowledging the reality of our changing climate and working to not only catch up, but to think about and think ahead to thresholds that are responsive to climate change and to a resilient climate system and to our mitigation and adaptation options. So, you know, bringing our water quality standards to current science and ensuring that our standards are specific, they're measurable, they're outcome-based, and that the effectiveness of regional actions can be tracked and seen in them. Devin discussed earlier, you know, our looking at environmental restoration and the opportunities for carbon sequestration and promoting projects on the ground that are restoring our forests, our meadows, and our stream environment zones in order to best locate those carbon sequestration options, you know, and not doing so in those dense forest areas, but really looking at targeted areas for restoration and removing aging infrastructure. And forest health, you know, again, defensible space, fuel reduction, really looking at how we are better providing that wild land urban interface, hazardous fuel reductions, and again, looking at landscape style, landscape scale restoration to ensure that our thresholds both promote and encourage, you know, the types of activities that that we're doing in the face of climate change. So real quick, you know, a reminder of what's next. We'll happy to take any questions and go forward. But at this point, you know, as we said, the content for the threshold evaluation is ready to go. We basically made very few substantive changes in the evaluation from draft to final. And so today we're really looking for the board to both issue the final evaluation and we can create those final that final document, but really to basically move us forward to restart and reinvigorate our threshold update process. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions that you have.
Great, thanks, Ken. Really appreciate the presentation. I want to apologize. I introduced you as Ken Kasman, and I know it's Kasman. But I said that a few times, and I just can't get myself to make K-A-S-M-A-N Kasman. But I will. So thank you very much for such a thorough report on threshold evaluations. I would like to ask my fellow board members if they have questions or comments on this. It's getting late in the day. So if you don't want to send me a chat, if you would just let me know verbally that you have a question or a comment, that would be great. And if we don't, then I will jump into public comment. It looks like we're going to public comment. Ken, very thorough, obviously very informative, and I think everybody understands where you're coming from. So thank you very much for that. Let me jump to the public comment here. Okay. One second. Okay. If any member of public wishes to address the governing board on this agenda item, please raise your hand now and go to webinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff. I'm going to turn it over to Catherine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are no hands raised to comment on this item.
Okay, I'll come back to the board. And we do have, assuming there are no further comments, there is a motion to be made. Do I have a motion? Anybody?
I'll give it a shot, Mr. Chair.
Great, thanks, Wes.
I move to adopt resolution 2021-, issuing the final 2019 threshold evaluation report.
Okay, assuming no further question or comment on that or discussion, because I don't see anything on the chat. Maria, would you please take roll?
Ms. Saldine.
Yes.
Mr. Beyer.
Absolutely, yes.
Mrs. Sagaski.
Yes.
Ms. Faustinos. Ms. Hill.
Yes.
Mr. Friedrich.
Yes.
Mr. Lawrence.
Yes.
Ms. Gustafson.
Yes.
Mr. Rice.
Yes.
Ms. Novosel.
Yes.
Ms. Williamson.
Yes.
Mr. Yates.
Yes.
Mr. Bruce.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, that motion passes.
Great. Thank you, Ken. Really appreciate it. See you next time.
Thank you.
Okay, we now are moving to agenda item number 7 on reports. I'm going to pass this over to our executive director for her status report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of quick mentions today in the report. I think you heard earlier, Julie referred to next month, we are planning a governing board retreat for all of you. This will be in person, out of doors, open air. And our main objective, since we have not seen one another in person in quite some time, is to actually give you all some opportunity to engage in person with one another. So it'll be the first opportunity for some of our new members, as well as our veterans, to mix and have some time together. In addition, we'll bring some substantive discussion to you all during that time. But importantly, this is your opportunity to have some social time together. So this will be a two-day board meeting next month. So Wednesday, the ordinary day of our business meeting, will actually be the day of the retreat. And then Thursday, July 29th, we will hold our governing board business meeting. So it's just important that you all keep in mind that next month it's 2 days, and to hold those days. I don't anticipate that the second day will go a full day. So it'll be something on the order of early to mid-afternoon is what we're anticipating. So stay tuned for more details on this, but please hold both those days, July 28th and 29th. Secondly, we anticipate next month, we're currently working on kind of retooling our approach to these governing board meetings. And so we anticipate the start of hybrid meetings, starting with that July governing board meeting. Well, we'll give on the day of the business meeting on Thursday, we will be giving governing board members and the public, as well as staff, the choice to participate either in person or at the TRPA offices. So we're still working out the logistics and details of that, but I fully anticipate that if you want to participate in person, you'll have that option starting in July. So that's all I have today, unless you have questions.
Any questions for Joanne? Okay, hearing none. Marcia, do we have a legal report?
No, we do not.
No report about what's going on with John on his hike?
Right. Well, I was just going to say, we may have a report when he gets back about how much fun he had on his backpacking trip.
Okay, good. Well, we're looking forward to that.
All right.
Okay. Thank you very much, Marcia. And thank you for being here. We appreciate that support.
Happy to do it.
Agenda item number 8, governing board member reports. I do want to just make a quick mention that with respect to the discussions that we were having during AIS on shoreline and wake zone and safety, we are working on that. And things are in the works, and we will continue to work on that. Do we have any other governing board member reports? If you have one, please jump in. Okay, hearing none. We'll go to committee.
Mr. Chairman, get off of mute.
Wes, please.
My wife comments on that once in a while. Excuse me. I did want to say that I had the privilege of being at the groundbreaking ceremony for the new visitor center at Spooner Park. And we had several members of the TRPA that were there, along with NDOT and state parks and whoever. And it's going to be a lovely facility, and it's going to be right, hopefully, at the terminus of the new pedestrian walkway from Sand Arbor to Spooner. And hopefully we will, in the near vicinity, have a transportation center someday, hopefully. So it was delightful to be there, and it was great to see Julie, and she did a good job representing us.
Great. Thank you, Wes, for that update. Really appreciate it. And I know a few other board members were there and really enjoyed it as well. Okay, we are moving to committee reports, agenda item number 9. Anything, Sue, on local government and housing?
No, not right now, thank you.
Okay, nothing for legal committee. Operations and governance. Anything, Shelley?
Thank you, Mark. Well, last month we heard a report on concerning the work on the rock wall at the TRPA offices and the roof. We hopefully next month we'll have an update on some of the interior building improvements that are planned, and we'll be talking about perhaps using some of our surplus to fund some very much needed software upgrades.
Thank you. Thanks for that report. I appreciate it. So EI Transportation Public Outreach. Jim, any report?
No report, Mr. Chair. We did not meet this month. I do anticipate that we will be meeting next month, I hope, to get a report on the ongoing work of the consultant that was just hired to work on transportation priorities and funding alternatives. But hopefully we'll get together soon.
Good.
Thanks.
That sounds great. Thank you. Okay, let's see, Bud, Forest Health and Wildfire.
Yeah, I think we're scheduled next month for a meeting of our committee, and I think we're gonna have a presentation by the Tahoe Fire and Fuels team. And then John Friedrich, one of our committee members, has raised an issue that we're gonna have a discussion on, and that involves the biomass projects. So that'll be next month.
Okay, thanks, Bud. I appreciate the update. And Bill, RPIC.
RPIC, in addition to the mobility mitigation fee, we did have an excellent presentation on the housing work that's being done. The first phase of the work that's coming out of the Tahoe Living Housing and Community Revitalization Working Group, and also our housing committee that Sue has, you know, taken this one on and done a really great job on. And so we heard the necessary changes on the bonus unit boundary to make sure that we're incorporating all the areas that would encourage affordable workforce housing to take advantage of the bonus units by expanding that boundary, I think just 15%. We're addressing the non-conforming density issue between the TAU and residential changes. You can convert your motel into a residential and not lose units. And then on the accessory dwelling units, I think we'll see a recommendation from staff that's conforming our regulations to what California has done on ADUs, leaving it to really Douglas County and Washoe to decide where they want to go as they get into this issue more than the California local jurisdictions have. And then we have some, you know, some cleanup stuff on development rights, but it was an excellent presentation by Karen Fink. And, you know, I look forward to those final recommendations, I guess, coming back to us probably at the end of the summer. That's it.
Agreed. Great, thank you so much. Just wanted to mention that it was great to see everybody on the screen. It's going to be even better to see some of you next time, definitely at the retreat, but next at the next meeting, hoping to see some of you in person. And really good to get back to some kind of normal here. So with that, we're going into final public comment. And I'm just going to read a few things here, and then I'm going to ask Catherine to take us through public comment. Thanks, everybody, for the meeting. Our final matter of business is our general public interest comment period. Any member of the public wishing to address the governing board on any item listed or not listed on the agenda, including items on the consent calendar, may do so at this time. Individuals or groups who have already commented on items listed on the agenda are not permitted to comment on the same topic. The governing board is prohibited by law from taking immediate action on or discussing issues raised by the public during the public comment period. We'll hear comments on any single topic not on the agenda for up to but not to exceed 30 minutes. We will hear as many unique comments as possible. We will hear comments for up to but not more than a total of 60 minutes. All unheard comments can be submitted via email to mambler@trpa.gov and will be forwarded to all governing board members. If any member of the public wishes to speak at this time, please raise your hand and go to webinar. You will be unmuted one at a time by TRPA staff, will indicate that you have the floor. I will now turn it over to Catherine to manage the final public comment of the meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are no hands raised to make a comment on this item.
Okay, so we will deem public comment closed. At this point in time, we're going to agenda item 11, adjournment. Do I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, we are adjourned. We'll see you next month. Thanks, everybody, for such fantastic participation and involvement today.